light up and take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about the revolution.
This Week in Radical History, for the week starting November 10th. We start out this week with a Howard Zinn quote. There is no flag large enough to cover the shame of killing innocent people.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
This Week in Radical History for November 10th, 1887, Louis Ling, one of the 8 men accused of the bombing at the notorious Haymarket Riot, he is found guilty on very weak evidence and Long, with 4 others, sentenced to be hung. Lang, however, had a dynamite cap smuggled into his cell in the state and detonated in his mouth, cheating the state out of its glory. All the anarchists, by the way, were posthumously pardoned. At the trial, Louis addressed the court in this way. I despise you. I despise your order, your laws, your forced propped authority. Hang me for it. Also November 10th, the Wilmington Insurrection of 1898 occurred. Originally labeled a race riot, it is now also termed a coup. This incident is the only instance of a municipal government being overthrown in U.S. history. The Wilmington Insurrection was the illegal seizure of power from an elected government of black office holders by white supremacists, who used, among many other weapons, including Gatling gun, to kill off black office holders and install their all-white members to government. Also on this date in 1910, anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman sets out to organize public protest in response to the pending execution of Japanese anarchist Tsuchiya Kotoku, who translates anarchist writings into Japanese and is executed for it. In 1950, U.S. Air Force B-50 bomber carrying an H-bomb develops engine trouble over Canada. The Air Force crew members detonate the bomb with the plutonium core removed, scattering 45 kilograms of highly enriched radium into the atmosphere over Quebec. In 1973, Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-5 is labeled a tool of the devil by school board, and a teacher who signed it for reading is fired. Slaughterhouse-5 is a commonly censored book because it's realistic. American soldiers behave as soldiers. They talk and swear and curse like men do, and its language often irreverent, including one of my most favorite quotes from this book. Quote, the gun made a ripping sound like the opening of a zipper on the fly of God Almighty. Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-5. Banned by many school boards across the United States.
The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down at the big lake they call Gitchagumi. The lake, it is said, never gives up her dead when the skies of November turn gloomy. With a load of iron ore, 26,000 tons more than the Edmund Fitzgerald weighed empty. That good ship and true was a bone to be chewed when the gales of November came early.
On November 10th, 1975, ore ship Edmund Fitzgerald and its crew of 29 is lost in the storms in Lake Superior. No, it's not very radical, but I wanted to insert the song here because I like it. Here's a little more of that song.
Does anyone know where the love of God goes when the waves turn the minutes to hours? The searchers all say they'd have made Whitefish Bay if they'd put 15 more miles behind her. They might have split up or they might have capsized. They may have broke deep and took water. And all that remains is the faces and the names of the wives and the sons and the daughters. Lake Huron rolls, Superior sings in the rooms of her ice water mansion. Old Michigan steams like a young man's dreams. The islands and bays are for sportsmen. And farther below, Lake Ontario takes in what Lake Erie can send her. The iron boats go as the mariners all know. With the gales of November remembered.
In a musty old hall in Detroit, they prayed in the Maritime Sailors' Cathedral. The church bell chimes, it had rang 29 times for each man on the Edmund Fitzgerald. The legend lives on from the Chippewa down of the big lake they call Gitchagumi. Superior, they said, never gets up for dead when the gales of November come early.
How come Andrew gets to get up?
That's right.
If he gets up, we'll all get up. It'll be anarchy.
You long-faced, overdressed anarchist.
You've come to the wrong shop for anarchy, brother.
Anarchy in the UK!
Anarchy in the UK, anarchy all over the world. In remembrance of the Haymarket Martyrs today, November 11th is International Anarchy Day. So go out and give your favorite anarchist a big old kiss, will you?
Yeah, what you're describing is anarchy. Are you an anarchist?
You mean, am I a member?
An anarchist group, yes.
Anarchists have a group?
I believe so, sure.
'Cause baby, I'm an anarchist in the finest little room.
I'm not afraid, I'm not afraid, and I'm not ashamed of all getting drunk. And I don't care what you say, 'cause I believe in anarchy.
So also on November 11th, 1831, American slave rebellion leader Nat Turner hanged in Jerusalem, Virginia. Nat Turner, leader of the Bloody Slave Revolt 3 months before, a slave and educated minister, believed himself chosen by God to lead his people out of slavery. Some of his actions were controversial for indiscriminate killing of whites. However, not to be outdone by the uppity slaves, the white military comes into town and hangs about 60 slaves, most of whom had nothing to do with the uprising. And again on November 11th, 1887, the Haymarket Martyrs, August Spies, Albert Parsons, Adolf Fischer, and George Engel, all anarchists, executed in Chicago. A fifth, 23-year-old Louis Lang, killed himself in the prison cell the night before, cheating the state executioners. Prosecutors never found evidence that they threw bombs, and the so-called police chief fabricated evidence in the trial of the Haymarket Massacre defendants. 250,000 people lined Chicago streets during a Parsons' funeral alone. The execution elicited international outcry. All the Haymarket Martyrs would eventually be posthumously pardoned as the truth of the police lies become more and more evident. Also on November 11, 1918, the war to end all wars ends without an end to wars, with 8.5 million dead, 21 million wounded, 7.5 million prisoners and missing, plus a worldwide influenza epidemic killing another 22 million by 1920. As we heard from the movie MASH, war never ends, they just take it on the road. From a short poem called The Little Song of the Maimed by Benjamin Perret, about a town in France where the largest casualties of the war occurred, and is also a place of my birth, Verdun, France. Lend me your arm to replace my leg. The rats ate it for me at Verdun, at Verdun. I ate a lot of rats, but they didn't give me back my leg. And that's why they've given me the Croix de Guerre, the Cross of War, and a wooden leg, and a wooden leg. More World War I veteran news in 1919. Wesley Evers, after serving in World War I, became a lumberjack and a member of the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW. During the celebration of Armistice Day in 1919, members of the American Legions attacked the IWW Union Hall. The result was a fight that resulted in the death of four men, two of whom were killed by Evers. Wesley Evers uttered the words during the hall defense, "I fought for democracy in France, and I'm going to fight for it here. The first man that comes in this hall, why, he's going to get it." Evers was arrested and held in jail. During the evening of November 11th, a mob stormed the jail, castrated and tortured Evers. No one was ever charged for this crime, proving once again the value veterans have in this country once they are all used up.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free.
More American-born and bred haters in 1978. Gay San Francisco City Supervisor Harvey Milk and Mayor George Moscone are assassinated by ex-supervisor Republican politician Dan White. White is later convicted of the lightest charge possible in the infamous Twinkie defense. A defense argued that White was depressed because of overconsumption of junk food, and he gets only 7 years in jail for killing two people. He would get out in 5 years after good behavior and less Twinkies, of course.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free.
Right now, there's a movie out about the first gay San Francisco mayor called Milk, starring Sean Penn. This week in Radical History for November 12, 1788, Mexican governor recommends that Navajo establish themselves in permanent villages in the South. 75 years later, under U.S. jurisdiction, the U.S. terrorist army begins to burn those villages. Also November 12, 1920, President of Haiti, unhappy with the U.S. administration, appointed after President Wilson sent in the Marines to Haiti in 1915 to protect American interests, asked for a congressional investigation into the poor state of U.S.-controlled government. Haiti, at one time one of the wealthiest Central American states, is to this day devastated by U.S. colonial interventions. Lastly, for November 12, 1984, a plowshares protest targets silos with pruning hooks, a Minuteman nuclear missile silo in Knob Moister, Missouri. After using a jackhammer and air compressor to damage the silo lid, protesters Carl and Paul Cabat, Larry Cloud Morgan, and Helen Woodson leave behind the Bible and Native American indictment of U.S. government. From the book of Isaiah, they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. This week in Radical History from November 13, 1921, the Supreme Court ruling definitely prohibits Japanese from becoming naturalized citizens on the basis of race. This ban lasts until 1952. The decision says members of certain ethnic groups are not entitled to naturalization citizenships since they are clearly not Caucasian.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free.
Two more items from November 13, 1969, in New York. Bombs have exploded over the past several days at the RCA building, Rockefeller Center, the GM building on Fifth Avenue, the Case Manhattan Plaza, United Fruit Company Pier, the Criminal Court buildings, and Marine Midland Grace Trust Company, and several other federal and corporate buildings to protest government corporate involvement in the Vietnam War. Lastly, in 1974, Karen Silkwood, popularized in the movie Silkwood, is murdered during her investigation of Kerr McKee nuclear power plant in Oklahoma. All her documentation of safety violations somehow disappear.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on Truth and Justice Radio. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. And this is your host, John Roberts. This morning we feature a rather remarkable conversation between Israeli historian and author Ion Pape and Israeli journalist and author Gideon Levy, held at Westminster University in London in June of 2016. It is moderated by anthropologist Ruba Saleh. The conversation and question and answer period exceeds the time limits of This Week in Palestine, so we will present this feature over two broadcasts. We think you will understand why we want to broadcast the entire presentation when you hear the quality of the conversation. So this week, we present the first half of this interchange between Ion Pape and Gideon Levy, moderated by Ruba Saleh. And we begin with introductions.
you, everyone, for coming tonight, and mainly thank you to Gideon Levy and Ilan Pape for being with us, and thank you for inviting me to moderate this fantastic event tonight. So I will introduce our two speakers, who, of course, don't need much introduction, but I think it's still due. It's a celebration of their role and work that they've done. And then I will conduct the evening by asking a few questions and then open it up to the floor for a debate, for a discussion. So Ilan Pape, as most of you, of course, know, is an Israeli historian and activist. He's a professor at the College of Social Sciences and International Studies at the University of Exeter, and he's the founder and director of the European Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter. Before coming to the UK, he was teaching at the University of Haifa in Israel, where he was directing the Emil Tuma Institute for Palestinian Israeli Studies. I think that, there is no way to list and all the books that Ilan has written, and there are more than 10, 12 books, so I won't be able to go through all of them, but I would like to mention some of the latest work, The Biggest Prison on Earth, A History of the Israeli Occupation of Palestine, which has just really come out in 2015, The Forgotten Palestinian, A History of the Palestinian Minority in Israel, 2011, the book he's written with Noam Chomsky, Gaza and Crisis, and of course the very celebrated Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, which was a paradigm shift book for the Palestine question. The other guest tonight is renowned journalist Gideon Levy, who was born in Tel Aviv, from parents who escaped from Czechoslovakia in the late 30s. He's, of course, as you all very well know, an active spokesperson for the Palestinian suffering in Israel and the West Bank and Gaza. He's an editorialist in the newspaper Haaretz and regularly contributes to other media outlets. He has for 25 years written a column entitled Twilight Zone on the hardships of life in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip, which also gave the title to his book, Twilight Zone, Life and Death Under Israeli Occupation. Another book that he's written is titled The Punishment of Gaza, which was published in 2010. And Gideon is also the recipient of many, many awards. And again, the list is so long, I would just like to mention the prize that he won in 2015, the Olof Palme Prize for Human Rights, which was awarded to him together with the Palestinian pastor from Bethlehem, Mitri Rahib, for their fight against occupation and violence. A very warm welcome to our guests, speakers tonight. I think I would like to start by asking a question about the right of return, and particularly Blake mentioned a little bit the history of my family. My parents and grandparents were born in Haifa and Jaffa, and as well as my parents and many other Palestinians, they fled in 1948, and they became refugees together with 800,000 Palestinians. Today, this number has grown to 5 million of people in the world. Some of them still live in very grim lives in refugee camps. They have been deprived of rights. They have been considered guests in the host countries where they have fled, even when they have received citizenship rights. And at the same time, they haven't been allowed return to their homeland. Of course, we know that the Nakba didn't stop in 1948. It's an ongoing project of dispossession that takes place on a daily basis. And no home, no place is really home for Palestinians. There is no safety in most of the countries where they have fled up until today. And of course, we know that many scholars have produced outstanding scholarship that tried to defeat the paradigm, the Israeli Zionist notion that there is no space for all of us in the land. Salman Abu Sitta, a very well-known Palestinian political scientist and geographer and demographer, has written a book that showed that there is space for everyone if we all wanted to return, that there isn't a question of space. And other sociologists have shown that, in fact, the right of return is a right that should be given, but it is by no, there is no, not at all, any reason to think that 5 million of people will want actually to return. So my question to you is, on the other hand, Israel has always represented this issue of the right of return in terms of an apocalypse, like the idea that there would be an apocalyptic move, that it will mean a new exodus for the Israeli Jews, and still is refusing to be held accountable for what led to the catastrophe, to the Nakba. So my question to both of you, and I guess you choose who wants to start answering the question, is what do you think of the right of return for Palestinians, and how do you see the right of return as building into a vision of a once democratic state for all, rather than as a threat to the existence of Israeli Jews?
So kind, you don't.
No, we start with the light stuff, you know, right of return. So you take the light stuff and I'll get to the real core.
Okay. Yes, I think that in the hindsight of 70 years since 1948, we have a very clear idea what lies behind the official Israeli rejection of the right of return. And this is not any worries about the capacity of the country to absorb new people. In fact, Israel is built on the notion that it can absorb many more millions only if they are Jews, or at least considered to be Jews. So it's not a question of capacity. It's a question of ideology. To put it bluntly and simply, it's a racist position. We have a very good proof for this. There are 300,000 internal Palestinian refugees inside Israel. Even the claim that a return of Palestinians would change the demographic balance between Jews and Palestinians does not stand the test of proof, because these Palestinians are citizens of Israel. So allowing them to return to their villages would not change the demographic balance between Jews and Palestinians inside Israel. So why doesn't Israel not allow these Palestinians to return? And it would never allow these Palestinians, not even one of them, to return. And this has to do with a settler colonialist ideology, which totally excludes the native population, whether the ones who are still there, or those under occupation, or those who were expelled from any equal status, either as a human being or as a citizen in the Jewish state. So I think one has to understand that the basic rejection of the right of return is, I would say, the consequence or inevitable outcome of the Zionist ideology. The same ideology that led Israel to expel these people is the same ideology that prevents them from coming back to their homeland. So I think where this was maybe not wasn't very clear in recent years, I think now we have an easier task in a way in showing that. I would add, and with this I would end, and then maybe we can develop it a bit later on, I would add another aspect that sometimes escapes the attention of anyone who is engaged in this in conversation about the right of return. I recall a public debate in TV I had with the late Pundak. What was his first name? The young one.
Owen
Pundak, who was one of the architects of the Oslo Accord. And we were debating the right of return. And he said something very honest from his perspective. He said, you do realize that even if it would have been possible for Palestinian refugees to return, most of Israel would look like Wadi Ara. Wadi Ara is one of the places of concentration where Palestinian citizens live today. There are three places, the Nakab, the Galilee, and in the east, Wadi Ara. And I said, even if it's true, what's wrong with that? I mean, I really enjoy seeing Palestinian villages. And he really did not understand he didn't think I was honest. He really thought it couldn't be that someone who grew as an Israeli Jew would like to see Israel with an Arab landscape. with even an Eastern Mediterranean landscape. This is why the Zionist movement brought not only European immigrants, but also European trees to cover the Palestinian villages, and was very reluctant to bring Jews from the Arab countries, because they were Arabs, and they had to de-Arabize them, which they did quite successfully. I think that's also part of this. It's not only not accepting the accountability for what they did to the Palestinians, it's not only protecting the Jewish nature of the State of Israel, it's continuing the fabrication that Israel or Palestine is not part of the Arab world and not part of the Middle East, which lies at the very heart of this attitude.
Yeah. I wish I had such a crowd back home. Things would have been so much better and easier. Ever since I remember myself, even in times in which I was still a good boy Israel or a good boy Tel Aviv, when I did the right things and I served in the army and even worked with Shimon Peres, which is even worse, I can tell you that I was exposed to spreading fears. Everything was fearful. The 67 borders, Ilan, you remember, were defined by Abba Ibn as Auschwitz borders, not less than this. Swine flu was presented in Israel as an existential threat. The regime in Israel throughout the years, and especially the current government, but also others, based their survival, based the ideology on spreading fears. And everything was always represented to us, even as children, as enemy. All the Arabs want to throw us to the ocean. Gamal Abdel Nasser should be compared to Adolf Hitler, and we used to burn his puppet in Lag BaOmer. It's a Jewish holiday where we light fires. We used to burn a puppet of Nasser, because he is such an enemy, he wants to throw all of us to the ocean. And the return was another subject, maybe the biggest subject of this fearful reality that we were living in. It was almost illegitimate to mention it at all. It's also today illegitimate to mention it at all. Like it is illegitimate in Israel to dare to define yourself as non-Zionistic, God forbid. It is as illegitimate as to dare to claim that Palestinians and Israelis are equal human beings, and the Palestinian people and the Jewish people gained or should gain the same rights. But the right of return was really the demon. And I'm not surprised that Ron Pundak was reacting as he reacted. And this goes together hand to hand with our main subject tonight, and this is the one-state solution. The one-state solution was perceived until 1-2 years as something that you don't talk about in any framework. I mean, this is far beyond logic. This is far beyond any kind of sanity. This is insane even to mention it. Because it's very clear that the right of return and the one state go hand to hand. Because finally it comes to the basic. And the basic is the basic question. Do we face two equal peoples with two equal rights? Or we face a privileged people and another people? And the right of return is endangering the whole project. Because all of a sudden we'll have to realize or to admit that we are not ready to go for equality. That there is a privileged people. That there is a chosen people. That Palestinians and Israelis are not exactly the same human beings. Because otherwise how will we explain the fact that any one-third Jew or half-Jew from Ethiopia can just take the first plane, land in Ben Gurion and get the Israeli citizenship in the airport, while a Palestinian who was born or his family was born for decades and centuries, can't even visit his family? How will we explain this if we will get to this dangerous path of equality? And the right of return had to be presented as the mother and father of all demons, because would we recognize this, we'll have to recognize equality. We'll have to recognize or realize that both peoples can bring anyone back to his homeland. In the Palestinian case, it's back to the homeland. In our case, it's to our, I don't know how to call it, new homeland. But in any case, it must be equal. So, in the last 1 or 2 years, I must say, there were first cracks in Israeli society. One state can be mentioned already. Don't misunderstand me, we are far, far, far away from any real discussion in Israeli society. Israeli society is living in total denial, and maybe we'll talk about it later, in total denial, in total blindness, moral blindness, totally disconnected with reality. I mean, I think if the Israeli society would have been an individual, it would really call for help. Because people who are so disconnected with reality might be dangerous, either to themselves or to their environment. And there are treatment. Not always it's hospitalization, but something must be done with those levels of denial, with those levels of living in an alternative reality which is totally disconnected with the real world, which is totally connected with what is happening half an hour away from our homes. So in the recent 1 or 2 years, people start to mention one state, and maybe the next step, it didn't happen yet, will be also mentioning the right of return, you know, maybe in a limited way. But by the end of the day, and this will be my final sentence, by the end of the day, don't misunderstand and don't be wrong. Israeli society doesn't deal with it. Israeli society has no interest, not in the occupation, not in the fate of the Palestinian people, not in equality, not in peace, obviously, which is off the table. Israeli society is now interested in totally different things, like the next vacation, the new car, career, money, nothing else but this, nothing else but this. And the best way to handle it is always to ask Israelis, what do you want? Where do you want to go? What do you want it to be in 10 years, in 20 years? And you will never get an answer, because there is no answer, because people don't discuss it. I remember still times when the joke was that two Israelis share 3 views, and today 3 Israelis hardly share 1 view. And this view will always be the nationalistic, racist, and many times also religious view. And the right of return is still something which is not only unacceptable, which is perceived and presented deliberately as life or death, as suicidal. The day that we will accept the return of 20 refugees will be the day of the end of the Jewish people.
Thank you. I think I wanted to pick up on Gideon's last comment about the fact that in the last 2 years there starts to be a sense in which the one state is gaining ground, and of course this is happening also among Palestinians, although of course nobody can talk for the 10 millions of Palestinians' aspirations and visions. But there seems to be kind of a paradox whereby, on the one hand, the devices that Israel put into place, which are physical, legal, cultural devices to continue dispossessing the Palestinians of their land, of their water, of their food, of their culture, of their memory, of their history, is in a way counteracted by a solution, the one democratic state solution, that seems to be equally gaining terrain, almost as a result of these series of devices that that want to prevent this from happening. And I guess for this, those among us, the Palestinians among us who see this as a possible way out, it is also something that calls into question the nationalist project, as you said, the nationalist project that is going to be an exclusionary project one way or another, or the other. Whereas the one-state solution, in a way, brings into the picture the issue of rights, rights for everyone, equal rights for all, rather than national claims or affiliations. So it will be a redefined political space that will focus on equal rights. And I think that the Palestinians in Israel, in a way, are already at the forefront of doing this, of unveiling the paradox of a state that on the one hand defines itself as a democracy, and you define it a very feeble democracy, and on the other is continues its settler colonial project of exclusion, of violation of international law, of discrimination of its citizens on the basis of ethnicity. So I'm just wondering, what do you have to say about the fact that in a way it is the Palestinians in Israel that are already embodying this vision of the one democratic state by their daily battles of making the state a really inclusionary one, which would mean, of course, changing its parameters, changing its skeleton, changing its political vision and constitution. So I would like to ask Ilan, who even have written a lot about this.
Yeah. I think you point to a very important kind of development, but I would kind of maybe look at it from a different perspective in a way. Israel has, since 1967, created a matrix of power by which it controls historical Palestine. And within that space, which used to be historical Palestine, it controls different Palestinian groups with different means. It is true that the Palestinian citizens of Israel, compared to any other Palestinian group, fare better than the rest of the groups, in a way. But they are still treated as aliens within their own homeland, despite the fact that they may have the right to vote, they may have the right to be elected. And for many years, especially for the Labour government or Labour movement that was the hegemonic power in Israel, and even for certain important groups within the center and the right, the idea of the two-state solution, the idea that there is a green line, that there is a kind of two geopolitical realities, one which is called Israel and the other one which is called something else, whatever it's being called, it was used in a way, first of all, to fragment the Palestinian people further. Secondly, to send a message that there are Palestinians who would fare better and Palestinians who would have lesser status. And to say that actually for themselves, especially as liberal Zionists, they found an ideal solution of how to have an ethnic state, a racist state, and yet to be considered a democracy. Because the small number of Palestinians are part of the citizenship because demographically they don't threaten the Jewish demographic majority. And there are so many mechanisms in place that do not allow them actually to take any significant role in the political life that it doesn't matter if they are considered outside as being real citizens compared to the others. Now, this was, I think, until the end of the last century. Until the end of the last century, you could have kind of built a model that would say, that Israel wanted to build. Almost, I would call it the good Palestinians and the bad Palestinians. But since 2000, liberal Zionism disappeared. Most of the people in Israel who now hold power do not believe anymore in this ability to juggle the two balls together, that of racism and ethnicity and that of democracy or liberalism. And because of that, they themselves, and you're absolutely right, and that's the paradox, they themselves annulled, nullified the green line. The green line. They created one space. They imported methods they use in the occupation into Israel itself. So the reality where you had like at least two ways of being a Palestinian, if not three ways of being a Palestinian under Israeli control, is transforming. There is only one way of being a Palestinian within the Jewish state. And of course, it's worse to be in Gaza than to be in Haifa. But you are still treated in the same way. And the future, as far as the powers that be in Israel are considered, is the same future. And I think that helped to undermine the developments that happened on the Palestinian political scene as a result of the Israeli policy of fragmentation. If you divide the group to five, a nation, to five different groups, after 70 years, each group develops its own agenda. But if the powers start to create one space, one geopolitical space, the agenda, even if people wanted to create different agendas, let's say for Palestinians in the West Bank, or Palestinians in the West Bank, or the Palestinians in Israel, the reality does not allow you even to do that, even if whether it was a good idea or bad idea. In other words, what Gideon was talking about, the emergence of the one state solution as a viable solution nowadays does not only come from people who conceptualize the reality in a different way and fought all their life against the two-state solution or had a very strong moral conviction that the one state was the only right solution. It comes from the ground itself, from the reality on the ground. And the reality on the ground is that we all live in one state today. There's only one state. Israel controls the life of every Palestinian in different means, directly or indirectly. So the question is, what kind of a one state you want to have? I know that the two-state discourse is still alive among politicians, diplomats, and journalists, and academics, but this is really the last years of this discourse. There is a limit for how much a discourse or a conversation about a reality can be separated from the reality itself. It can last for a while. These kinds of dissonances can be maintained and sustained by certain academic, political, and economic forces. But there is a limit, and I can see this coming to an end very soon. So I think in this respect, you're right that there is a contradiction, but on the other hand, I actually understand the connection between the two, between the Israeli policies and the reemergence. I just want to add one sentence, which I think is very important, and with this I would end. There is, it's not a false discourse on the one-state solution, but it is a discourse on the one-state solution of people who haven't thought it through to the end. And I'll explain what I mean. And you also alluded to it as not alluded to it, you sort of posed the question, how does the one-state solution relate to the project of the liberation of Palestine from a national or even a nationalist perspective? Is there a contradiction between being a member of the Palestinian Liberation Organization that believes in the liberation of Palestine from a national perspective and the idea of a democratic state which is more right-centered or orientated towards granting rights? And I think that's where, I wouldn't call it the false one status, but this is the one status who haven't thought things to the end. Because you cannot really have a democratic one state solution in Israel, in Palestine, without relating to the liberation of Palestine. It has to be a project of the liberation of Palestine as well. Now, I'm not saying it as a slogan. This is a very practical, functional thing. I'll give one example. You cannot start a one-state solution by just granting civil rights, equal civil rights to everyone between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean, and hope that by this you started a new era in the life between the two communities, the settlers and the natives. No. You have to redistribute the resources. you have to rectify certain injustices, which can be, not every injustice can be rectified. People who are dead cannot be put back to life. But land that was robbed can be given back or can be compensated. It's a very painful process to build a reconciliation for a one-state solution that is also a liberation project. And if it will not be a liberation project, it will remain a topic for conversation in our living rooms, and it will not be a real political movement. That's the only way of making it a real political movement. And we have one bad example with South Africa. Because it was very clear that in South Africa, Mandela had to make a very important decision. He can have a one democratic state in South Africa if the white community is not going to pay any economic price for that transformation. And he agreed. He fully and knowingly and consciously signed an agreement which said the economic apartheid continues, the political apartheid is over. South Africa is in a much better position where it was. I'm not underestimating it, and I wish Israel and Palestine were there. I'm just saying that in a smaller country,
as the introduction said, I worked for a long time in the International Labour Organization.
Kind of concentrated,
and although I was always regarded
in areas where people are so intensely intertwined in one another, one into the other, if this would not be a teaching process, an educating process for the settlers as well as for the natives, just declaring that everybody has equal rights would be a futile intellectual exercise.
I should never appear with Ilan because after he talks, what shall I say? First of all,
bless you.
First of all, I would like to mention the sense of humor of Israeli propaganda. The other day, I was participating in the Oxford Union debate last Thursday, and it was about the one state. The question was, is the two-state solution still attainable? And whom do I see in the other camp in front of me? The official spokesperson for the Israeli embassy. Israel is for the two-state solution. This was really surprising. I just asked him, where have you been in the last 50 years? Where have you been when it was illegitimate to mention the two-state solution? People went to jail for this. And what stopped you to go for it until now? I mean, what stopped you? So this must be mentioned, that finally this terrible, cheap, unprofessional propaganda has also a sense of humor. And I really appreciate it. I think that Israel is the only state in the world, I guess, with having three regimes. Not one regime, but three regimes. And this continues your way of thinking, but now I'm talking from another point of view. In the front, there is this half-liberal democracy for its Jewish citizens, which has now more and more cracks, which is in danger in those days, real danger, but still operates like quite a reasonable liberal democracy. And they always give me as an example. I have total freedom to express my views, even though I needed a bodyguard for a while, but still it might be perceived as a democracy. And this is in the front. Then comes the second regime, which is a regime of discrimination toward the Israeli-Palestinian citizens who live within the 67 borders, who gain formally full civil rights, they can vote to the parliament, they can be elected to the parliament, they have obviously freedom of movement, Israeli passports, anything that on the formal basis should be perceived as equal rights. They are discriminated in any possible field, in any possible field, we'll not get into it, but it's really systematically, the legal, the economical, the cultural, the educational, you name it. Anyone who has any doubts about it is just invited to come one day to go to one of the towns or villages and say no more. I mean, it's enough to see in what conditions those towns are when there is a neighboring Jewish town, a much younger, and you see it at once. It's enough to go to court, to Israeli court, and to see for the very same, and there were researches about it, for the very same crimes. What do you get if you are an Israeli-Palestinian, and what do you get if you are a Jewish citizen? But still, regime number two, it is still not the worst. And then comes the third regime of Israel, of this very same Israel. And that's obviously the regime which looks like apartheid and walks like apartheid and talks like apartheid and is apartheid. Two people sharing one piece of land in the occupied territories. One people gain all the rights in the world. The other people has no rights whatsoever. I don't even understand how can people argue about the question, is it apartheid? I mean, just open your eyes. How can it be not apartheid? I mean, how can you call it if not apartheid? I once hosted a delegation of human rights activists from South Africa. And, you know, I took them to a refugee camp of Balata, and by the end of the day, I asked them, no, what I was waiting to hear. And they say, no, there's nothing to compare. It is much worse than our apartheid. So in any case, worse or better, that's the third regime of Israel. And whenever we discuss Israel, and whenever Israel claims to be the only democracy in the Middle East, and the Western outpost in the Middle East, and the villa in the jungle, and all those beautiful, beautiful expressions, let's remember that, unfortunately, nobody can be half pregnant, even though it might be desirable from time to time, and nobody can be half democratic. And Israel is not a democracy, because Israel has three regimes and not one, and there is no regime, there is no democracy which holds in its backyard one of the most cruel and brutal tyrannies on earth today. And I'm not exaggerating. The military occupation in the West Bank and the occupation of Gaza, which is in different ways, is today one of the most cruel, brutal, and criminal regimes on earth. Not less than this. Not less than this. So getting back to your question, which is almost forgotten because Ilan took it far away. Ilan complained before we came here, he complained about people who ask questions which have nothing to do with the topic. Exactly. So in any case, the Palestinian community, the Israeli-Palestinian community in Israel is now really in a transformation phase. There are all kind of contradictory processes. On one hand, they become more Israeli in a way. They will read newspapers in Hebrew. They will watch Israeli TV. They will become more Israeli in the way they talk, they dress, the cars they buy, etc. In the same,
the Israeli are becoming more Palestinian, stealing our clothing.
I wish.
Our food.
Your food we stole a long time ago. I was brought up as a child, a little child. We had a song about falafel. You know, the Italians have spaghetti. The French, those are the lyrics. The Italians have spaghetti. The French are eating frogs. The Austrians have schnitzel, and we have falafel. This was the first occupation. But in any case, they are going through a very interesting process now. The young generation, the first generation was totally paralyzed. Second generation was also partly paralyzed by the trauma of the Nakba. And now we are facing, so on one hand, they are going more, I would say, an Israelization process. On the other hand, they are going to a Palestinization process. Their parents cared very little about the occupation, I must say here frankly, very little about the occupation. They were concentrated in their own struggle, and there was very little solidarity, there was, but not as one would expect, with their brothers and sisters, which who live just 5 minutes away in many cases. But now there's a new generation which really one should follow very carefully, because they might bring a lot of hope. They will not give up, and they will not let the Israelis do whatever they want, the Jewish Israelis do whatever they want with them. It is, like anything else, a long way to go, because racism and fears are so deep now. I live in a most liberal neighborhood in Tel Aviv and maybe in Israel, and even there you see all kind of phenomena of I don't want delivery made by Arabs, I don't want Arabs to come to my home, really things that could happen only in Israel those days. And you know, there is also the incitement, and we can't ignore it. There is a systematic incitement now against the Israeli Palestinians by the government, above all by Netanyahu. Yeah, this will be my last thing. You know, racism is everywhere now in Europe, and extremist right wings are everywhere. But there is no place today on earth that racism is so legitimate and so established like in Israel, where a prime minister and ministers and members of parliament can say things that no other place on earth they would be accepted as politically correct. Racism is today in Israel the new political correctness, and it's aimed also at the community of the Israeli Palestinians.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I just wanted, because Gideon rightly said that I took off a bit from the main road.
A bit.
Because you mentioned something, Ruba, which I think maybe is what you also meant, that this kind of interaction for more than 70 years between two communities, even within the matrix of separation, segregation, and apartheid, creates joint realities. I mean, even when you have ideology and a government that tries by force to separate people, to segregate people, and in Israel the police, very much like in America in the case of African Americans and whites, the police is the main border between Jews and Palestinians in Israel itself, especially the border police. They're used to create like a living kind of boundaries by creating or trying to prevent any spaces where people can live together, talk together, work together, and dream together. And I think it is important to remember that in spite of everything we said, and I'm not trying to undermine everything we said, especially in the Galilee, and maybe that's the difference between Tel Aviv and the Galilee, because the Galilee, 50% of the population are Palestinians and 50% are Jews. Tel Aviv, as our dear friend Amnon Raskakotskin says, is the only big Western metropolis without Muslims in it. The Galilee is binational. It's really binational in many ways. And it's interesting that in the Galilee, where the project of Judaization was the most celebrated in Israel, namely how they created exclusive Jewish neighborhoods, towns, and settlements by law, despite the power of the State of Israel. Most of these supposedly, allegedly, exclusively Jewish spaces are binational. It's quite incredible. The most important town established in order to prevent Palestinians from growing is Upper Nazareth. They even used, they didn't have no shame in using the same name as the Palestinian town to say there's a Jewish Nazareth and there is a Palestinian Nazareth.
And which one is the upper?
And the upper one is supposed to be the Jewish one, built on the land expropriated from the Palestinian one. 30 to 35% of the people in Upper Nazareth are Palestinians. And they went into it despite all the policies that we're trying to prevent. And some of these new kind of realities develop in a bad way. I don't want to idealize it. Some of them develop in a beautiful way. And maybe by that, what you meant, that there is there a model that tells us something about not only the impossibilities of living together, but also about the possibilities of living together. And I remember I did the piece for the London Review of Books on Upper Nazareth, so I called the, from a Palestinian friend of mine who lives in Upper Nazareth, I called the spokesperson for the municipality of Upper Nazareth, and I asked, can you please tell me how many Palestinians are living in your city? And she said, we don't have Palestinian citizens. And I said, that's very curious, because I'm sitting in a house of a Palestinian who lives in Rachel Street 15 in your city. Is he not part of your city? She said, oh, so maybe we have one or two. And I said, but that's very strange, because the whole street are Palestinian homes. She said, oh, we may have a street or two, and so on and so forth.
And then she called the police.
and this kind of denial on the one hand and the reality that they cannot transform is something that maybe should give us a little bit hope when we talk about the way Israel itself created the one-state solution, which in a way is much better than the false aspiration for a two-state solution that created these two spaces, the democratic Israel and whatever the Palestine state would be, who cares, but that's the solution. So in a way, there are some grains of hope in otherwise a very, as Gideon described it so well, a very racist, apartheid kind of.
You have been listening to Israeli historian Ilan Pappe and journalist Gideon Levy speaking together at Westminster University in London. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The Royal British Legion, but why are they taking money from arms companies? Amidst the controversy in football and with FIFA banning the poppy from football T-shirts, we also recognise that it's Armistice Day today and Remembrance Sunday on Sunday. So it's the time, this time of the year, when Veterans for Peace get together every year for their annual conference. Also, British journalist Vanessa Beely is hot foot from Aleppo. She's been telling a very different story to Channel 4 News about what's going on there. Millions of our taxpayers' money being spent propping up Al-Qaeda terrorists, the so-called Al-Nusra rebels, who are holding civilians as human shields. What we're seeing on our TV screens is bearing little resemblance to what's happening on the ground in Syria. Also, another great film this week, which still hasn't been shown on our televisions, Shadow World, about the global arms trade and how it's corrupted politics right across the planet. And the religion of war. We look back to the last Republican president, George W. Bush's Iraq victory speech, how hollow those words seem now. With a suspended Professor Anthony Hall from Canada. Sister show Dialects here on BCFM 93.2, noon every Tuesday this week. A bit more from Vanessa Beany too. And also the best of the Bath Buskers. But first, I'm joined on the line by James Floren. He's a former infantry soldier in the British Army. Hi, James. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, good evening. Thank you for having me on.
James, tell us a little bit about yourself. How come you got involved in Veterans for Peace?
I've been involved in Veterans for Peace for some time now. I've got a background in the Army, the British Army. I was in the Royal Gloucestershire, Berkshire and Wiltshire Regiment. And I joined Veterans for Peace because of their message, because they moved me, they spoke out to me. It's very significant that there's a Veterans Peace movement, for who knows war better than the veterans that have fought there. And who knows the monster of war better than the veterans that have been through it? And Veterans for Peace are one of the only groups, if not the only group in the world today, that consists of soldiers, sailors, air personnel that have been through war and that can speak from a grounded position out against war. So they really reached out to me. And I've reached out to them as well.
Well, look, let's scroll back a little bit to your past. Why did you join the infantry in the first place?
I was homeless, jobless, and my fiancée had just dumped me. So I was in my 20s, which is a little bit older than most recruits. They're usually teenagers. I like to think of myself as a kind of old-style recruit from Queen Victoria's age, where it used to be called conscription by starvation.
So what do you mean by that?
Kind of unpacking that a bit, the British Army has usually maintained a regular professional force, but they recruit from the most vulnerable people in society. People that can't afford to eat, people that can't put a roof over their heads, the rejects of modern society, if you like.
So I suppose you could say that some of the austerity measures, taking away people's benefits, etc., is going to actually help with recruitment.
It may do, possibly. We don't know. We're hoping that it won't. We're hoping that young people today are a bit more sophisticated, perhaps a bit more switched on and a bit more aware of what the armed forces actually means and does. They lie to us. They tell us, join the army, see the world, play sports, have a great adventure. They don't tell you about the downside, which is that you go to war. that you kill people, and that you could be killed yourself.
What about today? It's Armistice Day. What does that mean for people like you in Veterans for Peace?
Well, Armistice Day is an interesting point because it was revived in the late 1990s by a group called the Western Front Association to coincide with the 80th anniversary of the armistice. And there are around 100 veterans of the Great War left alive. And it was more a kind of nod to them, a respect to these guys that were getting very old and dying off very quickly. It was the last significant anniversary, if you like, of the Great War, where survivors could take part and remember their dead pals. But it's been carried on. For some reason, we still remember Armistice Day in the United Kingdom. We stopped for 2 minutes. We're invited to, anyway, by the powers that be. So it seems quite bizarre that we are invited to remember something that's out of living memory, if you like. Does that make sense?
Well, I mean, surely it's even more important that we remember the sacrifices made in the past and also maybe learn from those mistakes.
Oh, absolutely. But we can do that in other ways. We don't have to partake in any kind of establishment organised, very military-centric style of remembrance. We have schools, we have an education system, we have libraries, we have books available to us, we have lots of information where the mistakes of the past and the successes of the past can be learned from.
What about there seems to be a bit of an attempt, doesn't there, to conflate things like the Second World War, where we are trying to stop the tyranny, Hitler's tyranny, which was rolling the tanks, rolling across Europe, etc., and the British playing a quite important role in that and actually stopping that the hideous things like the concentration camp methods, the Gestapo methods, and Hitler's ideology, you know, being so horrific at the time, and conflate that with the more modern invasions like Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah, absolutely. That's an interesting point. I would have to point out that Veterans for Peace, our slogan is, war is not the answer to the problems of the 21st century. The 20th century is over. It's finished. It's in the history books. We can't change that. As I kind of touched on before, we can certainly learn the lessons. But it's an age-old trick that the powers that be, that the some sections of the mass media, people in control, always like to kind of paint their bad guy, if you like, as another Hitler. He's the sort of benchmark, the gold standard of the nasty person. President Nasser was called that in 1956, prior to the Suez invasion. Saddam Hussein was called another Hitler in 2002, prior to the invasion of Iraq. So it's a very sort of tricky point that we all have to, as movements, as people in the media, as people with consciences, it's a message that we have to pick apart, if you like, and question.
Also, the more modern, these more modern conflicts, the David Cameron actually himself comparing Putin to Hitler.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, every perceived bad guy, every leader that doesn't fit in with, let's call it Western policy, is painted or dressed up as a Hitler. It's fascinating, and it's very uncomfortable as well, personally speaking.
Martin, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is with us too, James. Martin, I wonder what you make of this, because it does seem that this kind of fits in with the kind of a propaganda model where we're going to be hearing for a little while from Syria, direct really, from Vanessa Bealey, who's been in Aleppo talking about what's happening over there. And she, one of the things she says is that actually what's happening on the ground has got really nothing to do with what we're hearing night on seeing night after night on our television screens.
Well, if you think about the history of the Second World War, the lesson that people thought they'd learned from the Second World War is that you have to confront aggression early rather than wait and appease the aggressor. But, of course, we're also forgetting the message of the First World War, which is that everybody grandstands in a belligerent fashion. You can end up with a conflict which nobody really wants, but you end up with it because everybody just backs themselves into a corner where they can't back down. And in actual fact, everybody comparing all these other people to Hitler is basically a historical anachronism. Hitler was Hitler, and comparing Putin to Hitler or Saddam Hussein to Hitler is absurd. And at the same time, of course, you know, we could compare the Saudis to Hitler, who have just invaded Yemen, killing loads of people. That would be silly. The Saudis aren't Hitler. The Saudis are a nasty regime, supported by us, armed by us, trained by our military, but they're not Hitler. They're Saudi Arabia.
Also, James, just there's been an article just come out this week, in fact, about the Royal British Legion, and I wonder what you make of it. The Tower of London's blood-swept lands and seas of red armistice. Of red armistice display, which was on display last year at the Tower of London, made a significant profit for a hedge fund investor who helped finance it. Ben Whitfield, former executive of Olympia Capital Management, made between £2 and £3 million, while artist Paul Cummings took home £7.2 million, which would have made him quite a hefty profit. After other costs, such as 1.36 for the tower management organisation, etc., etc., I mean, it just seems as if why are we in a situation where someone like a hedge fund manager is making so much money personally from this event at the Tower of London with all these poppies, where actually the Royal British Legion is supposed to be a charity?
Yeah, war is good business. It's good business for the arms manufacturers. And now it's good business. Remembrance has become good business as well. The Royal British Legion make huge amounts of money. I'm not sure how much actually goes to the veterans of war or the sufferers of war or the orphans of war or the widows of war, but I know the directors make huge sums of money themselves. They pay advertising companies and the advertising executives huge sums to do very slick adverts proclaiming who they are, what they're about. And that kind of gets siphoned off as well. It's become an industry. War is an industry. Remembrance is now an industry. And it affects the whole national psyche. I'd like to say that I myself, I'm homeless. I'm staying in a veterans hostel, a hostel for ex-soldiers in East London. But that's provided by a charity, a very small charity called Veterans Aid. It's not provided by the Royal British Legion. It's not provided by the British government.
Also, I mean, just to point out on the figures on the Tower of London blood-swept lands and seas of red display, that a third of the money raised by last year's Tower of London actually went to charity, Martin. So two-thirds went to the people that helped finance it and the various people behind the marketing of it.
Yeah.
Well, indeed, I think that's, you know, that speaks for itself. I understand that the Royal British Legion's Articles of Association say that they will campaign for the abolition of war. They were set up in the 1920s, and at one stage, wearing a red poppy on Armistice Day was definitely not seen as a pro-war statement. I don't think that that's necessarily the case today. I think that people's attitudes towards it have evolved, and not necessarily in a positive direction.
Also, there's another rather serious aspect to the way the Royal British Legion operates, and that is to do with the people that they take money from. Lockheed Martin, who are big arms manufacturers from the United States, the biggest arms manufacturer in Britain, BAE Systems. Thales, I'm not sure how you pronounce that, T-H-A-L-E-S, more arms firms. I mean, surely there, you have a view on whether you think this is right. Because I remember I found this article about this on your Veterans for Peace website, James.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. The Royal British Legion takes money from whoever will give it money. It's very much involved in the warfare state, as we call it. It's very much involved in militarism. It's very much involved in the war system, if you like. It's very much involved in promoting the culture of war and the cult of the military, something that we see has risen in the last 10 or 20 years, almost again by the powers that be, to try and justify the wars that are being fought overseas. And it's very mendacious of them, in a surreptitious way, to take money from the warmongers, from the people that are making the devices, making the equipment to kill people, to kill women, to kill children.
Now, Robert Fisk, he's a journalist that's been reporting on the Middle East in various British outlets for decades now. He doesn't appear on the BBC because the BBC don't want him on, but also because he has said publicly that whenever the BBC, they phone him up for a possible interview, they say, well, what will you say if you come on? And then they decide whether to have him on, determining what he's going to say beforehand. And so they only want him to say what they want him to say. So obviously that's one of the reasons you won't see Robert Fisk on the BBC, even though he's one of the greatest Middle East reporters and journalists in the world. The poppy, he says, has become a symbol of racism. I will never wear one again. The Entente Cordiale, which sent his father to France, is now trash beneath the high heels of Theresa May. Yet this wretched woman dares to wear a poppy. That's what Robert Fisk is saying this year, Thursday the 3rd of November. That's just actually towards the end of last week. And he says, yes, the boys and girls of the BBC and ITV and all our lively media and sports personalities and politicians are at it again. They're flaunting their silly poppies once more to show their super correctness in the face of history, and ignorant or forgetful as ever that their tired fashion accessory was inspired by a poem which urged the soldiers of the Great War to go on killing and slaughtering. But that's no longer quite the point, for I fear there are now darker reasons why these TV chumps and their MP interviewees sport their red compassion badges on their clothes. Who are they commemorating? The dead of Sarajevo, of Srebrenica, of Aleppo? No. The television bumpkins only shed their crocodile tears for the dead of First and Second World Wars, who were, save for a colonial war or two, the last generation of Britons to get the chop before the new age of we bomb you, die technology ensured that their chaps, brown-eyed for the most part, often Muslims, usually dark-skinned, got blown to bits, while our chaps flew safely home to the mess for breakfast. Yes, he's raging against the poppy disgrace every year, and his father, who was 12th Battalion of the King's Liverpool Regiment, 3rd Battle of the Somme, the liberating of burning Cambrai in 1918, finally abandoned the poppy charade when he learned of the hypocrisy and lies behind the war in which he fought. Now, James, that's pretty tough language.
Yeah, it's not for nothing that Robert Fisk is one of our greatest journalists and greatest war reporters. He's entitled to his own opinions, as we all are. He's entitled to wear a poppy or throw the poppy away. But let's not forget that after the Great War, almost immediately after, when there were Armistice Day parades, there were 24,000 veterans of the Great War that marched past a cenotaph wearing pawn tickets in their lapels because they couldn't afford to eat, they couldn't afford to feed their children, they couldn't afford to put roofs over their heads. And this was in the land fit for heroes, as Lloyd George described it. There was no land fit for heroes. It was back to the poverty of the Victorian class system. And let's not also forget that these same veterans, shortly after the First World War, broke the two-minute silence that's held on Armistice Day in a protest about the way that their lives were falling apart after serving their country and going to war and seeing their friends blown to pieces and ripped apart.
Now, to give the other side of this, Stuart Gendall, who's the corporate communication manager of the British Legion, said a couple of years ago of the sponsorship by armed firms, that money allows us to carry the work we need to do. Is a regrettable reality that war continues. The British Armed Forces require equipment, and BAE supplies much of that equipment. Without the best quality tools to do the job, we would be remembering more casualties of conflict. The British Legion spends £48 million, a couple of years ago this was, every year on counselling, small business and welfare grants, home and hospital visits and nursing. A spokesman for BAE defended its decision to support the poppy appeal. He said, for probably the whole of the last century, we have provided equipment for the British Armed Forces. It doesn't seem entirely unusual. We should sponsor the Royal British Legion in the way in which we have. After all, we are the legacy company that made the Spitfire, the Lancaster, and many of the ships of the Royal Navy. The Royal British Legion are all about remembering the war dead. This is a charitable donation, James.
Yeah, I mean, that's all very well, but the best way to save lives and protect the lives of British soldiers is never to send them to war again. We've been involved in so many wars. There's only been one year, I believe, in 1968, that a British soldier or member of the armed forces hasn't died in battle. It's a hypocrisy, and it's a disgrace to say that. We believe in Veterans for Peace, that the United Kingdom has been aggressors all over the world. There's only 20-odd countries that we haven't invaded or been to war with. If you look at a map of the world and you colour those countries in, it's absolutely phenomenal.
Hang on, you're going back to the Empire days now. We're not really responsible for that, are we?
Well, there's kind of one could argue that there might be neo-colonialism happening. If you look at countries that we're at war with now, that's as a result of our imperial conquests, certainly in the Middle East in particular. Palestine was under our mandate, and so were many other countries.
Also, of course, Martin, the Americans have kind of taken over where the British Empire left off, haven't they? I mean, they took over in the Middle East, effectively, at the end of the Second World War, with Roosevelt going in there and doing deals with the Saudi Arabians at the end of World War II.
Yeah, well, I think I feel very ambivalent about Armistice Day, because I don't think there's very few people who are complete pacifists, and I wouldn't include myself amongst them. But in actual fact, the problem is that we've been fighting on the wrong side in many of these wars, and we are the guilty parties. For example, BAE Systems is at the moment supplying weaponry which we trained them to use in Saudi Arabia, where they're carrying out bombing raids which are designed to terrorise the civilian population of that country. And that is going on. We're based in Bristol here. That's all started right here in Bristol. BAE Systems used to belong to the British government, as most Russian military industry still belongs to the government. Now, if the industry belonged to the government, then it wouldn't be a position to give charitable donations, because the government, you know, that would be absurd for the government to give charitable donations. They would have to, the government itself should provide support for veterans, and it shouldn't have to rely on charity. Okay. But BAE Systems is a profit making exercise. It's not a nationalised industry. It ought to be.
The warfare state, as you said, James. Anyway, just take us through, finally, what Veterans for Peace are up to this weekend.
We've got our annual general conference, and we're 400 veterans that represent every war that Britain's fought in since the Second World War. We even have a D-Day veteran, a chap who was the youngest person on D-Day. Was a 15-year-old sailor, and we come together, we discuss what we're about, what we stand for, what our campaigns are. We've also got our sort of cousins from the United States. The Veterans for Peace was started up in the United States following the Vietnam War, so we've had US Veterans for Peace visiting us as well. Tomorrow we've got a public conference. This is all down at the Quaker Centre in London, in Euston, and particularly the kind of highlight, if you like, the centrepiece of our annual general conference is Remembrance Sunday, when we kind of line up and we lay the only wreath of white poppies at the cenotaph.
What's the significance of the white poppy as against the red one? Obviously, the red one is the British Legion, which we've been slating here, really, as being in bed with the arms industry.
Yeah, well, the white poppy was started up by the Peace Pledge Union just after the First World War, and it remembers chiefly, commemorates or salutes, to use a military term, all dead. The Royal British Legion just want us to remember, in inverted commas, the British and Commonwealth armed forces dead. Not civilians, not the dead from other countries, just British soldiers, sailors and airmen. But the white poppy remembers everyone. But it's also for peace as well. It calls for peace. Whereas the Royal British Legion red poppy, we feel in some way, has begun to promote war, particularly in the last 10 or 15 years.
But Martin, we're in a very strange situation now with the British Legion, aren't we? Because this is an organisation that, as you said, as part of its rule, is about remembering mistakes from the past, not making those mistakes again, and now it's actually being fuelled financially by the people who profit from aggressive invasions of other countries and the dismantling of the UN Charter, for example.
Well, indeed. But I think I would regard the British Legion as a site of struggle. It's an ambivalent organisation, but I've got much more time for the British Legion than I've got for things like Help for Heroes, which really have no anti-war agenda at all. That was set up by the Murdoch press to support British imperialist intervention in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere. The British Legion, I think, has got a better reputation and is a more honourable organisation. And I think they need to the people who are active in the British Legion need to look at things like taking money from arms companies and consider whether it is appropriate.
James, I'm just thinking there may be people listening who have got veteran friends in their family that are also pretty annoyed about the way that the British Armed Forces have been being projected around as a kind of on the coattails of the Americans over the last 20, 30 years. I mean, it was in the 1970s, wasn't it? Harold Wilson famously said, no, we're not having British troops going to Vietnam. But it seems that we've been pretty much following the Pentagon ever since and continue to do so in many ways. So how can people find Veterans for Peace and sort of, you know, get people who are veterans to join your organisation?
Well, we've got a good presence on the internet. We have a webpage, vfpuk.org. We've also got a Facebook page as well, Veterans for Peace UK. That's distinct from the American Veterans for Peace. And if people click on there, they can find out more information. We've got several articles that guys have written. We have phone numbers on there. We have various contact points and people that can help with information, if you like.
Okay, James Thoren from Veterans for Peace UK. Have a very good Remembrance Sunday. Thanks very much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you. All the best. Take care. Bye-bye.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, that was a fascinating discussion there, I think, about the sort of more modern, sort of certainly, you know, we get the impression, Martin, don't we, that so the whole of the armed forces are behind these things, and often soldiers quite rightly, whilst they're on duty, shut up about what they're doing. But it seems increasingly there are some that are not prepared to carry on doing that. Anyway, Obama is directing the Pentagon to target al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria, one of the most formidable forces fighting Assad. Now, this is in the Washington Post today. This almost looks as if there's a beginning to be a shift already in US foreign policy, possibly after the election of Donald Trump, if the al-Qaeda affiliates like al-Nusra in Syria are being targeted by the Americans.
Well, there's an awful lot of disinformation. We're supposedly targeting ISIS, but our allies Qatar and Saudi Arabia and Turkey have been supporting ISIS with weaponry. There's no dispute about that. And of course, there's also a lot of indications that we ourselves have been supporting them. So this is a lot of grandstanding. We've got a situation now where it's becoming rather embarrassing that our allies in Syria are actually al-Qaeda, who we've supposedly been fighting a war against on several continents for the last 20 years. But in actual fact, it's not that such a problem at all. We are being manipulated. So we create these terrorist organisations and then we pretend to fight them. And the purpose of all of it is to make sure that we can stick our finger in
kind of
and steer geopolitics in the direction.
You kind of missed the point of what I'm saying. If Obama is now saying that al-Nusra in Syria has got to be attacked by Americans.
Well, I'll believe it when I see it, is all I can say. Because up to now, there's been a pretty solid drumbeat from the Western media that these guys are heroic rebels and that we ought to be supporting them. Now, it may be that there is going to be a change in US policy. If there was, I'm quite sure that plenty of people in Russia and in Syria would welcome it. But whether it's actually going to happen,
The Washington Post says it will be. Do you think Trump is going to change the way that we see the American? He has actually said, hasn't he, that the America can't afford to be the policeman of the world anymore.
Yeah, but I mean, the America isn't the policeman of the world. America is the gangster of the world. That's the problem. I mean, the self-regard of the US political class for itself, they see themselves as bearing the white man's burden, as it were, in all these countries. And in these countries, they're not seen as the police force. They're seen as the gangsters. And that's a huge step that they need to take. They don't, you know, Trump wants to, I mean, ordinary people in America don't want to get involved in all these fights, quite right. but they don't realise that they are involved in these fights and that they're not turning up as the police and bearing a burden. I mean, they are actually forcing everybody else into line. Like Western European countries, for example, they don't want to be part of NATO. They're made to be part of NATO so that we can keep the, so that the Russians can be kept out of Europe and the Americans can continue to dominate the economy.
James was saying there very clearly that there is a massive financial incentive these days. In fact, probably there already was in war, and this is extremely worrying. And one of the people that's written very, very well about this, in fact, probably the definitive book over the last 10 years or so, is the title of the book is The Shadow World Inside the Global Arms Trade by a former MP in South Africa for the ANC, Andrew Feinstein. And there's a film out recently all about this. Of course, it's not been shown on our TV screens, but let's hear a clip from it now. It's called Shadow World.
I got nothing against money. I don't mind paying bribes to politicians. The thing about politicians is that they're very much like prostitutes, but only more expensive.
The heads of government are the salespeople in chief of their country's large arms contractors.
For the last 50 years at least, policy has been made based on the assumption of greed, and it's ruined the world.
This very phrase, war on terror, it's nonsense. It's like saying a war on war. You're slipping into this possibility of kind of perpetual war.
The national security state not only seeks a perpetual state of war, it will even go to all ends to create that.
They make the mafia look like a bunch of schoolboys.
And it destroys diplomacy. It destroys the will to diplomacy, and it destroys the skill for diplomacy.
Bombs, they're like food. Munitions, that's got, you know, sell by date. You gotta get rid of it.
Blair came to South Africa to lobby that BAE, the British weapons manufacturer, won the biggest contract, $10 billion. Quite scarce public resources on this weaponry that we didn't need. And this is the template around the world.
BAE had channeled international covert payments all over the world to the local politicians.
Seems to be a very expensive way of organising bribe payment. Might as well cut out the military equipment and just hand out the money.
It's the disease of permanent war that destroyed the Middle East, not Islamic fundamentalism.
Companies are not only sort of part of the government, but they're effectively above the law.
It's okay to kill from a distance without a warrant, without a trial, without a jury, and the execution takes place off screen.
Once you start a war, you open a kind of Pandora's box. You don't control it. It controls you. And it propels you in directions you never thought you'd go.
Well, that's just a few clips there from the trailer of the film Shadow World. Martin reveals, it says, the shocking realities of the global arms trade, the only business that counts its profits in billions and its losses in human lives. Directed by John Guérin-Prez and part based on Corruption Watch UK founder Andrew Feinstein's globally acclaimed book, The Shadow World Inside the Global Arms Trade. Film reveals how the international trade in weapons, with the complicity of governments, intelligence agencies, investigative and prosecutorial bodies, weapons manufacturers, dealers and agents, fosters corruption, determines economic and foreign policies, undermines democratic democracy and creates widespread suffering. Well, of course, we like to think that the corruption goes on in countries in Africa and places like that, but actually the heart of it is here in Britain in many ways, Martin.
It is. If you look at something, a country like Saudi Arabia, for example, which Transparency International sees as a much more corrupt country than Britain, even a country like South Africa, or many other countries that we deal with, they are accused of being corrupt because they take bribes from our arms companies. But we're not corrupt. They're corrupt. It's a kind of racist inversion. Britain, the British arms industry and the British financial services industry are the heart, the centre of global corruption. We are right at the heart of global corruption here.
And also,
in this country.
I mean, we've been talking quite a lot since the top of the hour about propaganda, the sort of thing we get through Channel 4 News. I think nowadays, I don't know about you, but I'm quite suspicious whenever I see a child or a dying child, that sort of thing put on the TV screen. It almost always seems to be someone who is a victim of one of our enemies rather than the balanced reporting. So this is a little bit cynical. cynical, isn't it, where children are used as a propaganda tool like this? I mean, I don't think anyone would mind if it was both sides, but it's not.
No, it isn't. And we're being constantly emotionally manipulated by psychological warfare techniques. And, of course, children, we are biologically programmed to feel emotion when we see children being hurt or distressed. I work in a primary school.
So
I know what it's about.
Hitting us in the subconscious.
Yes, basically. It is. And, of course, the fact of the matter is we see a tiny fraction of what's really going on. There are no white helmets embedded with the Houthi rebels in Yemen to show us horrific photos of the aftermath, for example, of the attack on the funeral that killed 150 people a few weeks ago. The funeral, incidentally, of a very high-ranking rebel leader, and they knew that all of the people who he's allied with would be at that funeral, which is why they attacked the funeral. But, of course, we didn't see any pictures of that. No blood, no tears, nothing, because we don't really need to know about that war. That's a good war. That's a war you don't need to know about. But, of course, we're going to see the pictures of Aleppo from the White Helmets, which we fund, of course. We fund the White Helmets, who are embedded with the al-Nusra Front. So if the RAF, for example, tried to bomb the al-Nusra Front in Aleppo, they'd probably kill some white helmets.
Or the Americans.
Yeah. They've got no right to bomb anybody in Syria at all under international law, at all, because they've not been invited in there.
We've got Vanessa Bealey. We're going to hear from her now. She was doing a talk in Bristol this time last week, but I managed to catch her earlier this week with a bit of help from the Frome Stop the War group, speaking about exactly what you were saying, actually, Martin, which is the White Helmets and how both they and the British media are now becoming embedded in Aleppo with the terrorists themselves.
When you need the fire engine or when you need first responders in Syria, you call 113, exactly the same as, I hope it's still 999 in Britain. I haven't lived here for a while. There is no number for the White Helmets. There's nobody you can actually call. So that begs the question, well, what do people do who are in trouble? How do they get in touch with White Helmets? Or are they working purely as triage and support for the terrorist organisations with whom they're embedded? So the real Syria Civil Defence, who work in both terrorist and government-held areas, by the way, many of them have lost their lives going into terrorist-held areas to rescue civilians from under mortar fire or under guided missile attacks. The terrorist factions, by the way, to the north of Aleppo, particularly the ones in Idlib, to the north of Aleppo. There are three particular brigades, 13th Division, the Mountain Hawks, and I can never remember the third one, are heavily funded by the CIA, trained by the CIA, and armed by the CIA. And they now have Grad missiles, which have come in from Bulgaria and Tunisia, among other countries. And these Grad missiles are now being used also against the northern areas of Aleppo, the city itself and the surrounding countryside. And these missiles are used against these first responders. When they go into terrorist-held areas, what is happening is that the militant factions are picking them off. For instance, we have here the remains of a fire truck that went to a call-out in Homs. This is actually from the real Syria Civil Defence headquarters in Damascus. They went to respond to a call from Homs to a civilian area that was under attack from the terrorist factions. As they drove into the mortar-hit area, they were actually hit by a guided missile, and all three crew members were wiped out instantly. This is, again, to me, this is part of the criminal activity by our government to destroy the Syrian institutions, the Syrian humanitarian institutions, the Syrian state institutions that are so cohesive inside Syria. It's an extraordinary thing to witness. The Syrian state's efforts to keep supplying its civilians, to maintain its infrastructure, despite, one, crippling economic sanctions that affect the real Syria Civil Defence but do not affect the White Helmets. The White Helmets have no issue getting equipment into Idlib, by the way, from Turkey, from EU through Turkey and into Idlib. And then it's distributed to the White Helmet centres across the terrorist-held areas. They are not affected by the sanctions. These guys are. The real Syrian civil defence, if they run out of something, they don't get any replacement. For instance, the real Syrian civil defence in West Aleppo are dealing with chemical attacks almost on a weekly basis from the terrorists in East Aleppo. The reasons they lost one of their crew members, Mohammed Ibish, age 36, on the 2nd of August. Why? Because they have no gas masks. They haven't been able to replace them. So all they have are the paper masks, which are no defence against mustard gas, chlorine, any sort of chemical weapons that are being used against them in West Aleppo. And so, you know, this is a common occurrence, is that the Syrian state, the Syrian state institutions are battling the crippling economic sanctions, the intervention from NATO, which includes the invasion by proxy forces, and, of course, hostile propaganda, hostile diplomacy. This is Engineer Saad. He is based in the Damascus headquarters of the Real Syria Civil Defence, which, as we drove up to it, you have Jaish al-Islam directly and in front of you, about 50 metres away, and to the left you have Jobar, which is a very well-known terrorist-held area. So this entire centre is under attack on a regular basis. Every time they go out to respond to a call, they are driving through terrorist-held areas. This guy was hit. You can see his left hand is slightly, it's hanging. It's paralysed. He was hit in one of the attacks on the centre. He was operated on for about 8 hours, and he still has no movement in that hand. This ambulance, for example, was stripped clean by the terrorists, and they've been unable to replace any of the equipment in it, any of the life-saving equipment in it. So it's useless as an ambulance. When I was in West Aleppo and I was speaking with the Real Syria Civil Defence there, what they also told me, there were members of the crew there who came from East Aleppo to West Aleppo, and they told me that when the terrorists came in 2012, they massacred crew members, they kidnapped others. One of those crew members that I spoke to had been told if he stayed, he had to work with the terrorists. He refused, he fled. They burnt down his house, they put his name on all of the checkpoints so that if he were to come back, he would be assassinated. And his family, who had to be left behind in East Aleppo, are under constant risk of execution. What he also told me was that those terrorists that came in 2012 then were transformed into the White Helmets. But he categorically said to me, they are not humanitarian workers, they are terrorists, they are armed, and they are working alongside the terrorists. Another very clear example, Real Syria Civil Defence is a member of the International Civil Defence Organisation. Just prior to the Nobel Peace Prize announcement, the link to the Syrian Arab Republic, Syrian Civil Defence, was broken and reconnected to the White Helmets by surprise. So, luckily, we noticed it, and we phoned them, and this was a conversation that I actually had with the ICDO. We ran through basically what had happened. He said it was an administrative mistake, fair enough. But the interesting fact that came out of it was that they do not recognise, and neither does the UN, they do not recognise the White Helmet as a first responder civil defence organisation. Very important fact. As I mentioned, when you go to the White Helmet funding page, you'll see a very clear meme which shows all of the equipment and how you should be funding it. Well, that's very interesting if they were to be affected by the economic sanctions that is affecting every single other Syrian institution. However, as I mentioned to you, the White Helmets seem to be immune to sanctions. Then let's have a quick look at another media organisation, Channel 4. A very recent video that they put out and then very quickly took down. I don't know if anybody actually noticed this, but this is indicative of Channel 4's reporting on the crisis in Syria. They've run with a very NATO-aligned narrative. They've become very bullish. In fact, I mentioned today, they've become the Fox News of UK media to a huge extent. They bully their interviewees. They maintain their propaganda line even when faced with evidence to the contrary. And in this particular video...
It's early morning and they're planning an attack. Their way of defending East Aleppo is to hit back by sending suicide bombers to the Syrian army. And by launching rockets into the west side of the city.
They just normalise suicide bombers and attacks on civilians in West Aleppo. That was just completely nonchalantly put into the report as if it's perfectly normal that suicide bombers should be used as a legitimate weapon against the indigenous national army, or that it's normal that they defend themselves by attacking civilians in West Aleppo. But that's not the worst part of this video. The actual stars of this video were the beheadings of 12-year-old Abdullah Issa. So Channel 4 is telling you that child beheaders and executors and torturers are rebels and deserve to defend themselves against the civilians of West Aleppo by mortaring them, by sniping them, by explosive bullets. Extraordinary, I find that extraordinary. Here's another identification. So these are the actual beheaders. They're not even just associated with Norald and Zinke. They are the actual executors of that child. Now, when this was pointed out to Channel 4, and when in fact Channel 4 was attacked for this video, they immediately took it down. Fortunately, many of us took a copy of it. And then in among these nice beheading operatives that they called rebels, we find, guess what? The white helmets. Again, this is completely ignored by Channel 4. It's not even picked up on that somebody that has just been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize is running alongside child beheaders in East Aleppo carrying weapons. Great media we have.
That's Vanessa Bealey there speaking in Froome, actually, on Wednesday evening. Martin, it's just another unit of the British Army, it seems, Channel 4 News.
Well, I mean, the Channel 4 News are not the only ones who are spreading these lies and disinformation, are they? I think it's very... But the white helmets themselves were set up by James Le Mesurier, who's an ex-British intelligence officer based in Turkey, and we are funding them. But we are funding them to take videos which supposedly show the sufferings of the people of East Aleppo, but Channel 4 News went a little one step further there, where they actually show them mortaring and attacking the civilians of West Aleppo, where most of the people have fled to escape from their clutches. We are embedded with those people who are actually Al-Qaeda, who were supposedly the people who carried out the 9/11 attack, and why we've been gone to war in several countries over the last 20 years is to defeat Al-Qaeda, even though the British Army's psychological warfare operation is working with them in East Aleppo.
Interesting, yeah. Also this week, ISIS hunters, the SAS, are to track and kill British citizens in Iraq. British citizens affiliated to jihadist groups in Iraq will be hunted down as part of a new kill or capture strategy, according to senior defence sources here in Britain. A list of UK citizens that features around 200 jihadists currently at large in Iraq has been compiled by the US's intelligence agencies. The Times was told a kill list has been drawn up containing the numbers of hundreds of very bad people. A lot of them are from the UK. The hunt is now on for the British Islamists, who have effectively gone off-grid, an anonymous spokesperson for the MOD told the Times.
Well, I find this fascinating because it's quite possible... As we've uncovered on this show in the past, that it is the Western intelligence agencies, particularly the Turks, who have been recruiting people and pushing them in to Syria and Iraq of British and other origins, and now we're pretending that we're going to hunt them down. Now there's an element of basically make-believe associated with all of this. We know that ISIS and the Al-Nusra Front are armed and trained by our own allies, But we don't try and stop our allies arming and training them. We pretend to go hunting them.
One of the places that Vanessa Beedy said is absolutely clear is one of the most important for recruiting and fueling and keeping ISIS going is this town called Gaziantep, which is in southern Turkey near to the Syrian border.
Indeed, and those the Turkish army are our allies, and their chaps are all chained at Sandhurst, and they are the ones who are taking these British citizens and infiltrating them into Syria to fight the Syrian army, and then we pretend that we're going in after them to try and capture them. It's all a lot of smoke and mirrors.
And of course, we've reported on this show, and I finally managed to get it was actually Redress Online. Thank you very much. It finally published my article about Khadija Sultana and these three East London schoolgirls from Bethnal Green Academy who were trafficked over to Turkey and then helped by Canadian intelligence down to Gaziantep. And who did they meet? Well, they met a chap called Ibrahim Baki. He's a jihadist terrorist, but he's an English guy down in Gaziantep.
Yes, and he's quite likely working for MI6. So what we're doing is we're creating jihadist rebels, and we're recruiting them from all over the world, as we did in Afghanistan in the 1980s, and then we pretend to go and catch them, which means that we've got an excuse to intervene in Syria, even though we've got no right to be there at all.
And you might say,
local government doesn't want us.
You might well say, well, why do these people want to work for British intelligence? Well, what they do is they offer them, amazingly enough, they say to them, well, you can have British citizenship or Canadian citizenship if you work for us. And of course, they're in a war-torn part of the country. Do they want to make this horrible migrant refugee trip right across Europe to try and make it to Britain, or they just work for MI6 and they get a free ticket into the country? But what are MI6 doing? Is they're recruiting effectively what people who could be jihadists there?
Well, the implication is that many of the terrorist attacks at Nice, Brussels and elsewhere are actually being orchestrated from within NATO's intelligence structure, and they've been doing things like that going back to the 1940s, the Bologna bombing in Italy in 1980, according to the Italian police, etc. And when we have people like Yvette Cooper going on about how wonderful NATO is and how we must preserve it at all costs, does she know the real history of NATO and NATO's involvement in both Islamist terrorism and other forms of terrorism? I don't think she does she?
Talking of terrorism, run, hide and tell. This is Bristol Post again. What to do in the event of a terrorist attack? Police have issued guidance, assuming that's Avon and Somerset Police, on what the public should do in the event of a terrorist attack in Bristol. The information was issued as November the 13th marks the one-year anniversary of the Paris attacks, where gunmen and suicide bombers, in big inverted commas, we're not quite sure who, killed 130 people. The National Police Chief's Council put out the video, which states people should run, hide and tell in the unlikely event of a terrorist attack. Run to a place of safety. Then hide is better than to hide, then confront, and then tell by calling the police on 999. You need a simple message that will be quickly come to you. Run, hide, tell. We know from our research a lot of people are familiar with the message. We want everyone to watch the video and be aware of what we do. Police forces across Britain are training more firearms officers to respond to such threats. We also, didn't we? We heard this week of a shoot to kill in Luton. This is a little bit concerning when the police take call to a domestic incident and just end up killing the guy, shooting him in the neck.
Well, this run, hide and tell philosophy, you could say that's probably quite a sensible thing to do if you caught them in such an incident. But, of course, the telling is the important point. In the Nice attack, the CCTV footage of the actual attack, the security services wanted it wiped, because they didn't want any evidence of what had actually happened at the attack. And that's quite possibly because what happened at the attack is not what we're being told.
There's a lot of things. Of course, it's the anniversary this week of the, or next week actually, of the Paris attacks a year ago. There are all sorts of questions still about that, though, aren't there?
Indeed.
One of them, I remember watching a film of interview with the rock band at the Bataclan, and they seemed to be almost smirking as they were being interviewed. I mean, this is horrible. But, I mean, you know, there's no proper investigation, I think, into that.
No, well...
What are your major concerns about that attack?
Well, the Kouachi brothers, who claim to have supposedly be the masterminds of it, they left their passports in the car and then they were immediately rounded up and killed, so we'll never know who or what they were. But what we do know is that Western intelligence services have been recruiting all sorts of people to be infiltrated into Syria to fight the Syrian government, and then these people turn up in Belgium and elsewhere doing nasty things, or supposedly doing nasty things, and taking the blame. we are being manipulated by NATO intelligence services. We've been manipulated for decades. The track record of these people is enormous. The police in some parts of the world are very well aware of what these people are like and what they do. We need independent police investigations of these incidents, and one of the presumptions has to be that the intelligence services are behind these attacks.
Sorry, we haven't got time to hear Anthony Hall. We'll have to do that one next week. His interesting little analysis. He's the guy who's been suspended without pay from his university in Canada about the mission accomplished in Iraq speech by George W. Bush at the end of the Iraq War. We haven't got time for that. But, Martin, I suppose we should really be looking at the wider picture of the media and terrorism and what we can expect a year on from these Paris attacks, because it's quite clear, as we've heard from the Khadija Sultana case there, with the British and Canadian intelligence services actually inviting jihadists to come to Britain as part of their recruitment into MI6, we are facing a potential Gladio B here, aren't we?
We are indeed, and if anybody wants to know what Gladio are, they can just carry out a search online, and you will see that NATO's intelligence services have a track record of creating terrorism and then pretending to resolve it.
So, okay, well, that's all for this week. Final time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7 o'clock. Coming up is Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. And also, thanks very much to infantry soldier James Florin, who was with us just after the news at 6 o'clock. Thanks to our guest also in the first hour, who is Tom Baldwin from the Trade Union and Socialist Coalition, and also from Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance. Thanks also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Our sister show, Dialect, airs on BCFM at noon every Tuesday. This week we got more from Vanessa Bealey and also some busking from Bath. All that from www.dialectradio.co.uk. This show's page is thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. We begin the hour today in conversation with several activists, educators, and students about waking up in Donald Trump's America. We'll be joined by California Green Party activist Laura Wells, College of Marin professor Susan Rahman, who's also a Project Censored affiliate of ours. We're also joined by College of Marin student Caitlin McCoy. She is head of the Students for Social Justice at College of Marin, as well as a student representative of Media Freedom Foundation and Project Censored. We're also joined in studio by Anna Rivera, who is an activist and is completing her degree at California State East Bay, and she's been very active just even in the days after the Trump presidency. So we're going to hear a number of updates from these people. And we're also later in the program hoping for an update from Noah Traynor, who's a Sonoma State University student who's been delivering supplies and providing updates at Standing Rock, and he's been doing updates for the Sonoma State University Star, the student newspaper. And we'll be closing the program with longtime human rights activist Jack Healy. Some of you may know Jack Healy, who's worked with everyone from Dick Gregory to Sting and many, many others, the Aung San Suu Kyi freedom work. And his most recent efforts are directed at working on the campaign for Leonard Peltier. So we have an action-packed show today on social justice issues. So I believe that we'll go ahead and we'll dive into the first segment today. And Laura Wells, you are in studio with us. Thanks for joining us. Could you please talk to us a little bit about some of your initial reactions and some of your thoughts in the wake of the results of the November 8 election here in the U.S.?
Well, good morning, everyone. And one of the things that struck me strongly, because I grew up in Michigan and went there, went to college in Detroit, and Michigan was one of those states that shows where the institution of the Democratic Party has gone wrong. And they won in the primary. It was a very surprising upset that in Michigan, both of the seeming outliers won. Bernie Sanders won and Donald Trump won. And then when they substituted Bernie Sanders for with Hillary Clinton through a lot of what sure looked like dirty tricks to the Bernie supporters, what happened is that they lost people in Michigan. Do you know they lost people in Indiana? They lost people. The Democratic Party lost people because there are a lot of people in this country who are upset about the trade deals. NAFTA, the TPP, they know where their jobs have gone, and they're not happy with the Democratic Party that has helped usher all that in, starting with Bill Clinton.
Absolutely, that's right, and something that we need to remember. And I'm happy, Laura Wells, that you brought up your Rust Belt history, because I'm also from Pennsylvania and Ohio. It's a very real thing, and I have to say that Michael Moore was one of the people that kind of predicted the outcome of the election accurately. One of the few people, in fact. But I have to say that I was not terribly surprised, given what I was hearing from people back there. And one of the issues that seems to have escaped some of the analysis in the election, of course, there were issues certainly surrounding the Donald Trump candidacy involving race, racism, sexism, misogyny, sexual. So, I mean, just an amazing array of things that defy, you know, principles of equality and fair treatment and so on in the United States. But the one thing that often seemed to escape people was class and class analysis, and there's a lot of armchair quarterbacking going on around that. But again, coming from the Rust Belt, we maybe have some insight.
Yeah, and the way that the institution of the Democratic Party, so when I'm talking about Democrats, I'm talking about that institution. They are the ones that refused to allow Bernie Sanders to the light of day. And also, what's up with the Electoral College? I mean, one of the possible benefits to come out of this is getting rid of the Electoral College. But both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party could have at any time in the past few hundred years gotten rid of that thing, and they've kept it. But the Democrats have relied on the Democrats and the Republicans try to say, but particularly the Democratic Party, do not vote for anybody else but us. And then they give us a candidate that is obviously sold out to Wall Street, to the oil industry, to the weapons industry. And they say, and the Democratic Party is telling people, no, you can't have Bernie Sanders. Nope, you can't vote green. Nope. You can't, you know, and people are sick of it because they've been lied to. And one of the things in Michigan, the Rust Belt, actually the whole country, they don't like to be lied to over and over again.
I think one perspective on this, Laura Wells, is Paul Craig Roberts wrote a piece 2 days ago called "The Working Class Won the Election." And essentially what we had were millions of people, working class people, either not voting Democrat at all or voting for Trump. And that has resulted, I mean, less than half the people who are eligible to vote in the country actually participated. And there's been some blaming of the Green Party, but that's the numbers just don't support that at all. So do you think that this is an opportunity for working class people to really push an agenda that benefits everyone? I mean, we have to face the race issue and the equality issues and wages, but perhaps that's even more important.
Right. And one of the things that is significant in this race from the primary on was the role of money and the no corporate money. Bernie Sanders ran a no corporate money campaign. The Greens always run no corporate money for the candidates and for the party. Even Donald Trump, the billionaire, said that he wasn't taking money from corporate PACs. But the to be told, for the American people to be told, you have two choices. That's it. You cannot do, if you vote, for example, the Democratic Party has made a big point of, if you vote green, I mean, I've heard people say a vote for Jill Stein is a vote for Hitler. You know, they'll make that equation, and that has been programmed in for decades. But then people are saying, you're only giving me two lousy choices? Oh, yeah? You know, they're not going to go along with it. And the media has been, the mainstream media are the ones that say, these are your choices, period. They are the ones that eliminate all of the choices, and then people who get a lot of their information from TV, they make that calculation. It's pretty instant. These are the people that can win, and so then they choose not to vote.
So the corporate media, I see one study found that the third parties really got only 3 seconds of coverage for every 1,700 minutes on Trump and every 1,000 minutes on Clinton. So it's like you don't exist. And when, in fact, you know, there's a lot of issues that are very, very important that other parties are bringing out, but there's no play.
Yeah, it sure sounds like they're censoring.
It certainly seems that way.
So Dr. Susan Rahman is on the phone with us. She's a professor at College of Marin, longtime contributor to Project Censored. Susan Rahman, you're on the phone with us. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thanks.
So, Susan, you know, you and Peter and I are college professors. You and I in particular are at community colleges. And after the election, there was a stark reaction among our students. I know that we just came into class afterwards and they just kind of looked at me. I know they were just looking at around and saying, what is happening? And they wanted to talk about what was happening a lot. Can you talk to us about what was going on at College of Marin and what you're doing there? And then, of course, we'll bring on Caitlin McCoy and Anna Rivera, who are here in studio. Go ahead, Susan.
Yeah. In listening to what we've already spoken about, certainly class has been a big issue for this election. But, you know, what I'm seeing on the community college campus and just among voices that I'm familiar with, whether they be students that are in classes with me or students that I know through other ways, is that they're scared. You know, there's a lot of things at risk for a lot of the students that I know. This idea of deporting people, of, enforcing immigration laws to an extent that will put a lot of families at risk and terrify people on a daily basis is something that is a real feeling on my campus. Students were crying. Students were terrified. People are kind of going inward rather than reaching out, and it's really frightening. I came to work on Wednesday, right after the election, and we had a space for students to just come and process and, like, talk and hug and cry and do whatever we needed to do. And it was astounding. I mean, the voices were really scared. And so we thought about what we had to kind of go then to the next steps. I mean, I feel like we're in a state of grief. I mean, you know, this whole election was sort of a joke from the get-go. But, I mean, this kind of just pushed a lot of people over the edge in terms of, like, what their greatest fears are, you know, potentially going to come true. So we did a lot of then brainstorming about, okay, what is at risk with this presidency? You know, what would happen if he were to do the things that he says he's going to do? And then what are we going to do next? And so in some ways, I feel like this is an opening to, you know, a revolution. I mean, that's one way to say it. We've been teachers for a few years now, and I've always wondered, like, where's the tipping point? Where is the point where we all go, okay, enough iPhone, enough cheap, you know, clothes from Target or whatever it is. I'm ready to get off my ass and do something. Sorry if I can't swear. But I think students are ready, you know, out of selfish fear or just, like, disgust with the system or whatever. So I actually, as sad as it is that this happened, I also feel like this is a moment where things can actually change. And the students that I'm working with are scheduling a piece in for next week, and I can talk about that more later. But, you know, what are the issues at hand? What needs to be dealt with? And how can we all get involved? And I think the involvement piece is the piece that Project Censored is so closely aligned with. You know, it's figuring out what really is going on culturally and then taking that next step of, like, how can I work for change? And so that part of this, I think, is something really positive.
Well, Caitlin McCoy, let's bring you in to the conversation, a student with Susan Rahman working with us at Project Censored, and hear your perspectives, and then we'll bring in Anna Rivera. Caitlin?
Yeah, so a lot of people in my community are upset. A lot of people in my communities are terrified. There are documents being passed around about how to make sure that you've got all of your health affairs in order, how to make sure that you've got your marriage affairs in order if you are one of the people to whom marriage rights might be rejected as a result of this presidency. There are people who are trying to make sure that other people are taken care of, other people who are now at a greater risk than they have been, as we've seen with the amount of violence that has backlashed against people of color and people in disadvantaged positions since Trump was declared president-elect. And so as a result, the group that I work with on campus, Students for Social Justice, we have decided to hold a piece in at College of Marin this upcoming Wednesday from 11 to 2 p.m. on the Kentfield campus. And what we are hoping is to get nonprofits and community groups, organizing groups, to come and to table and to help students not only process but find out their rights, find out what they can do, find out what happens now, because we are not going to just sit and wait for someone older to tell us, well, you know, we lived through Reagan, so you should be okay. Plenty of people did not.
I lived through Reagan, and I can't say that it was okay.
Plenty of people did not live through Reagan, and that's part of the problem, is people died, and we are trying to keep our communities alive and safe and healthy, and we can't just sit back and watch. We have to be active, and I feel like that this has become a great impetus for that.
Indeed, it's happening at Diablo Valley College next week as well, and ongoing. It's happening at College of Marin, UC Berkeley, California State East Bay. Anna Rivera, that's where you are, Global Studies. So chime in for us. Talk to us about what you've been doing and what you've been seeing.
Well, first of all, buenas tardes. Thank you for having me. Definitely, there's two groups that I've noticed, the scared and the prepared. So the prepared would be people who were aware of what was going on, and that Trump or Hillary, we still had a lot of work ahead of ourselves, especially being Latina. I'm targeted instantly with either candidate, either if it's from Clinton's NAFTA or the walls that are going to get built. So either way, I was already a target. And on campus, we've been pushing to have a Dreamer Center get established. And now is the time to really get it moving forward with that and the Afro Room. These are two big issues that are currently being dealt with on campus, especially because these are two specific demographics that are instantly targets. And on the aspect of the students who are prepared, we're ready to stand on the front lines, whatever needs to, by any means necessary, like whatever needs to be done will be done. And if we have to have uncomfortable conversations, we will, because that's what needs to happen. And people need to start being comfortable with being uncomfortable, because the moment he was announced potential president, it was already an uncomfortable situation. So it's time to act. We've learned from it. We've had amazing ancestors show us the way and have prepared us how to respond properly. So now it's moving forward. At this point.
Indeed, that's Anna Rivera from Cal State East Bay. We are also joined by Caitlin McCoy, who's the head of the Students for Social Justice at College of Marin, and Susan Rahman joins us by phone, Dr. Susan Rahman, who teaches at College of Marin. We're also joined by Green Party activist Laura Wells here, California, live in the studio. We are going to take a brief musical break, but when we come back, we're going to continue this discussion with our activist educators and students about waking up in Donald Trump's America. We'll be back after this brief musical break. Stay with us.
I heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do you? And it goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall and the major lift.
is the late, great Jeff Buckley doing a cover of the now late, great Leonard Cohen, Hallelujah. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips, and today we are looking at sort of waking up in a president-elect, Donald Trump's America, and we're joined by California Green Party activist, former gubernatorial candidate, Laura Wells. We're also joined by College of Marin professor, Dr. Susan Rahman, and we're joined by students Caitlin McCoy and Anna Rivera, and we've been talking about the many different things that are going on and the reactions to what's happening here in the past week or so. Peter?
I saw something Wednesday night at Sonoma State that I had not seen in my 23 years there, and that was a spontaneous mobilization that was organized through social media, and all my students in my class at the time were saying, there's a rally, we have to go, and at 8 o'clock last night, 500 students or more assembled and marched quite loudly across campus, shouting no hate. And that seems to be the main message. Yeah, okay, Trump's been elected, but we want an administration with no hate. And that was that spontaneity of that, and the numbers that I saw I'd never seen happen on our campus before at that level. So I wanted to ask Anna and Caitlin about the kinds of things you've been seeing on your campuses.
Well... On campus, I also collaborate with SQE, which is Students for Quality Education. Anytime education is at risk, you know, we step forward. And right now, an issue that's at risk is, again, DACA, our undocumented, our Dreamer students. You know, they don't know where they stand. There is a lot of uncertainty. So those are definitely instant reactions. And also, shout out to all the faculty and the counselors, and I mean, they're just as heartbroken as we are, but they're holding it down. They're providing spaces for students to grieve, for students who, you know, our Muslim population. Like, we have a huge Muslim population of students on campus, and they're at risk too, you know. But at least on our campus, they have a safe space where we provide students a prayer room. So there's a lot of healing going on our campus, per se.
Caitlin, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, so again, we've had, as Susan mentioned, an offer for safe space on College of Marin's campus where teachers and counselors were present for students to process what their fears are with this coming presidency. As far as mobilization efforts, I have heard through the grapevine that something may or may not happen next week, but I don't know any details. We haven't had much on campus, but then again, we only really had 2 days before today, which is a holiday on our campus.
Yeah, so much is already beginning, right? It's already percolating. There's already been, and there's certainly been, there have been in the streets, right? Not just on campuses, but there have been major protests from New York to San Francisco and all around. Susan Rahman, do you want to chime in here again on the climate of the campus? And I know what you're working on, of course, on social justice there at College of Marin. And how do you see you moving forward here?
Well, I mean, we're going to do what we need to do. You know, I think that humans are resilient. In terms of what we're doing in terms of protests, there is a protest set for Monday morning. Students are going to gather at 9 o'clock and do posters and then march around. And so that's one thing that students are starting to work on. And we're having our piece in. It sort of feels like we're in the twilight zone, I guess I could say. I mean, I know some people were less surprised, but I think a lot of people were surprised. You know, we want to make sure that things are okay for our students, that, you know, that the police don't have, you know, now an extra, like, permission to be more aggressive with our students. So, you know, we're doing a bit of, you know, protecting ourselves through conversations and we're just going to continue to stay vigilant. I think, you know, this is that opening where there's room for conversations. And I think a lot of my colleagues at College of Marin are, you know, opening up the classrooms to talk about this. I think business as usual just had to be on hold for a bit while we kind of worked through this, because this is going to have real world consequences for all of us, and part of our, you know, daily lives going to school is part of real world. So making space for these conversations and making space in our lives, I think, for social justice is something that I would hope would be something that could be more common among people. You know, if everybody right now, as a result of this election, said, okay, 2 hours a week, I'm going to do something towards social justice. I don't care what it is. If everybody did that, we'd live in a different society. So I think kind of making that case for everybody getting involved and doing their part is a message that I see coming across the waves at my school.
Susan, how do you think activists feel when Trump is tweeting that all the protests are by professional activists?
I think he's just pompous and mean, and I don't care what he says in that type of situation. I mean, he's just spewing, you know, hate. He, his particular kind of way that he responds to things is so, like, you know, 8-year-old-ish that it's hard to even care what he says in that kind of space. You know, that's not true. The activism is coming out of a place of worry, out of a place of desire for change. I wish I was professional. I wish somebody was paying me to protest, but I'm just doing it because I care about the world and I want to make it a better place, and I think that the people that I'm working with feel exactly the same way.
Laura Wells, let's bring you back into the conversation. I'm sure you have plenty to add to this.
Well, and it's great that you're planning to have later in the show somebody from Standing Rock. That is one of those things that the water protectors on one side of the line and the earth destroyers, you know, the militarized police that are representing the earth destroyers on the other side. And in this presidential campaign, did either candidate come out, you know, to support the people in Standing Rock? No. But have many, many people gone there? Yes. And millennials as well as elders and everybody in between. And that's one of those, you know, draw a line in the sand. Are we going to protect our water or are we going to waste it? Are we going to protect the earth or are we going to waste it? One of the things that this whole thing has affected the Green Party in many, many ways, but one of the things that happened after a lot of the Bernie Sanders supporters saw what happened by what the institution of the Democratic Party did, they came to the Greens. They have been activating counties that have never been active and reactivating counties that have been on a pause button. And they've come in and using Facebook and getting together, as you were describing about how 500 students in Nothing Flat could get together, highly organized, very wise, just like the two young people we have here in the studio, and ready to be prepared to do what is needed. We're actually having on Sunday, the Green Party of Alameda County is having what we call a Green Sunday, second Sunday.
So that's November 13.
November 13. And it's on, or is Sunday November 14?
Monday is the 14th.
Monday, okay. So it's November 13 at 5 o'clock at the Neble Proctor Library, 6501 Telegraph. And the title of it is Welcoming the Next Generation into the Greens, Rebranding the Green Party, and being ready for both to have, you know, it's like, to me, the main job of the human species is to take care of the next generation. And so all of us are taking care of the next generation. One of the things that can bring tears to my eyes is the fact that I see these young people who are so young, and they're saying, we want to make sure that the kids have a better future. And they're talking about people even younger than themselves. And so we all have to roll up our sleeves and create that better future, and we definitely have the power to do it.
Ana Rivera, you want to step in here?
Definitely, yes. We have to in indigenous culture, you always prepare for the next 7 generations. And the good news is that we're the 7th generation that rises. So it's on us to really ensure that the next seven generations have water, have clean air to breathe, have access to whatever resources that they need. Coaching is, I coach U14 girls as well. I never saw it as a tool of social justice, but it's, with the team I have, it's, we talk about real issues. And on, we met before the election, and I told them, I looked at them in the eyes, and I was like, whatever happens, whatever president wins, like, you had nothing to be a part of this. Like, unfortunately, you will feel what happens after, you'll feel the aftermath, but you had nothing to do with this. So don't guilt yourself. At this point, it's like, how do I prepare for this? Like, where, how do I respond? And I told them, I was like, especially as young women with the misogynistic president, the strongest thing you can do right now is stay strong and stay together and unified. And yes, you know, the Democratic Party has been saying, you know, yes, be unified, but you shouldn't have split the people in the first place. So why do we have all of that? You know, there's all these divisions within our own political system, within our own communities, that we need to end all these divisions and really look at what is important for humanity as a whole, not just on our physical continent, but everyone on this planet, because we're the ones that are pushing forth either a better world or the finished destruction of it.
Yeah, and Ana Rivera, also, what you were saying there, it reminded me of so much of the rhetoric coming from the corporate media and both of the major corporate parties was so derisive of millennials. And even in the outcome of the election, in the Clinton campaign, basically, you know, talking about millennials as if they were apathetic or lazy. And now, of course, the millennials are being blamed for Clinton's loss. Of course, everybody's to blame except the Clinton campaign, the Clinton Foundation, the corrupt DNC, naturally. But again, I have to say, and you know, we work with so many wonderful young students and faculty, like Nolan Higdon, who writes about millennial and social justice issues. And we see on the front lines of social change and social justice, we see millennials as leaders. We see the young people really taking that baton and going in what we think is the right direction. And we need to be crossing these generational divides, not exacerbating them and building walls as people like Trump want to do. Caitlin McCoy, you want to jump in back here a moment?
Yeah. There's always been this assumption somehow that millennials are not politically engaged, that millennials don't pay attention to politics, that millennials don't care. And while that may be true of a small demographic, as it's true of like any portion of any small demographic, millennials are out there. They're out there in the streets of Oakland, and Oakland cops do not play. Oakland cops will come out in a group of 100 or more for a group of, you know, 25 people. So I know that is not an easy thing to do, to be out there in these streets, to be protesting, to be saying, this is not the world that I want. This is not the country. This is not the way that I want my life to be led. This is not the way that I want the lives for people coming after me to be led, by this bigotry, by this hatred, by this, you know, awful rhetoric that does nothing to support us and just shoves us further down. And I have combated this concept every time I've gone out to speak for Project Censored in particular. You know, millennials are involved. Millennials are there. The problem is millennials do not trust the system that is in place. And millennials have a damn good reason not to.
Yeah, indeed. Reasons, many, many reasons. Susan Rahman, we want to wrap up this segment with a few words from you moving forward. So, Susan?
Yeah, I mean, I'd really like to just invite and encourage anyone who's interested in participating in our Peace In on Wednesday to come to College of Marin and be a part of it. We're looking to just have a place where it feels like, you know, you're safe. There's going to be therapy dogs and food to fill your belly and just places to be quiet. But then also we're going to work on different aspects of our areas of concerns. And so we're going to have different tables from organizations offering solutions and ways to get involved and what
what, you know, what's really going to happen. Because I think what's happening is for the people who are still in the place of fear, they're immediately going to the worst. Oh, he's going to repeal Roe versus Wade. Oh, he's going to do this. Oh, he's going to do that. And what we need to do is we need to step back and really think about what actually can happen and then how we can be agents of change and not allow those things to happen. And so I'd love every person that's interested, from the old to the young, to come to this. I think that that this definitely is a student movement. I love that it is going to be a student movement, but I think that if we had a multi-generational attack, it makes us stronger, right? So the wisdom of the people who went through the 60s, that would be great to have their voices at this event too. And I think that with a little bit of work, we're going to be just fine, you know, and maybe this was the place where we could make the real changes that we've been trying to make for a long time on the progressive side.
Well, Susan Rahman, professor at College of Marin, and certainly your work at Project Censored has been fantastic. Your students equally so, and Project Censored is really a student-centered organization. We certainly invite all students that want to get involved in critical media literacy education and social justice, if that's an angle they're interested in. You can please contact us at Project Censored through our website, projectcensored.org. And Susan Rahman, thanks so much for all the work that you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
I'd also like to thank Anna Rivera, Cal State East Bay, Caitlin McCoy, College of Marin, for joining into the conversation here. Laura Wells, you're going to be with us for the remainder of the show as well, so we'll certainly be hearing from you some more. But I wanted to call attention here to Peter Phillips. We have on the phone, we weren't sure if we were going to be able to get him, but a student of Peter's, Noah Traynor, is on the phone with an update live from Standing Rock. Peter?
Noah has wrote an incredibly great article in the Star newspaper a week ago, and we interviewed him at that time, and now has returned to Standing Rock with a truckload of materials for winterizing the area, and is going to give us an update on what's happening. Noah, are you there?
I am, Peter. Hey, how's it going?
Great. It's good to hear from you.
I'm here by the hair of my chinny chin chin. You know, they got the cell phone jammers really working in full effect. And
well, we certainly
able to find someone.
We had that problem last week with cell phones working and then all of a sudden just dying. And so you're on a hard line there at a different location. So that's great to hear. What's the mood in the camp now with a presidency from Trump?
I can't give you an honest answer on that. I got to camp about 3 or 4 hours ago. I went and I received my press pass, and I haven't been able to talk to too many people, but I can tell you that energies in camp are high. The spirit in camp is high. I can see everyone across from left to right is building structures. Everyone is working together to get prepared for the winter time, and it doesn't. I don't feel, you know, there were certain feelings in the camp you felt after certain actions when there was lots of arrests. I don't know if what's happened today. As I was coming in, I saw a truckload of people going out. So I haven't been too in contact. I haven't been in contact with too many people on the ground yet. But from what I was able to feel, you know, I do feel the energy. People are, you know, preparing for Thanksgiving, and spirits are high, and everybody is well.
What kind of material did you bring up there?
So I had donations from many professors at Sonoma State University who were able to, who gave me money and allowed me to go to a Home Depot and purchase a bunch of plywood and 2x4s. So we got some cement. We're not sure if we're going to have permission to use some cement or not, but we're going to be building little shacks. We're going to be building shacks for the wintertime, little places where people can stay. We brought wooden stoves, wood-burning stoves for the insides of these shacks. I call them shacks. They're going to be little mini homes for people. These wooden stoves will provide, you know, when the weather is down to negative 20, they can keep these little shelters in like the 60-degree range, which is life-saving. It's not even that out here right now. So that's what we got going right now.
Well, Noah, I think you missed the 500-student march on campus Wednesday night against No Hate, but you were certainly on your way to North Dakota for your second trip, and We certainly applaud your effort. We applaud your effort in this concern. So stay in touch with us. And we really appreciate that you're involved there. And we encourage the continued resistance to the black snake going under the Missouri River.
Again, I thank you. I thank you guys for having me on. It sounded like you're having a bunch of other professors from the university field. I think that's really important to get people like that involved. So thank you again, Peter, for having me, and look forward to coming on again.
Okay, great.
So that's Noah Traynor, student at Sonoma State University, and we'll certainly be getting more updates from what's happening at Standing Rock as we can. We're going to take a brief musical break, but when we come back, we're going to be speaking with the head of the Human Rights Action Center, Jack Healy. Stay with us.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those nights in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to a USA. The wall on a visionary flood of alcohol, from the staggering account of the Sermon on the Mount, which I don't.
More from the late Leonard Cohen. This is Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips, and you are tuned to Pacific Radio. This is the Project Censored Show. Our theme for the hour has been looking at, through a prism or a lens of social justice and certainly human rights in the wake of the President-elect Donald Trump. And we are joined right now by a towering figure in the human rights and social justice movement from Human Rights Action Center. That is Jack Healy. And here is Peter to introduce Jack to you. Peter?
Well, Jack Healy was as a Pittsburgh native, born in an Irish Catholic family, youngest of 11 children. His mother and father were teachers and a meteorologist at Superior Steel. He was a Franciscan monk for 10 years and a Catholic priest for 4. Then he left the priesthood in 68 and is now the director of the Human Rights Action Center. And they specialize in promoting the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, trying to get that accepted as policy in all over the world. Jack, are you with us?
I am. Thank you, Peter.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And what's your take on the state of the United States with the Trump victory?
I think we're probably in deep trouble because the president-elect has chosen to endorse torture and even more, and the death penalty as well. So we're off to, I believe, his words. So I'm hoping we're able to turn him around. You want to remain optimistic about a new president. But having said that a number of times on the campaign, I think it's a deeply flawed approach to foreign policy.
Well, Jack Healy, thanks so much for taking time out and joining us on the Project Censored show. And I'd like to thank our mutual friend Stephen Jay for connecting us and putting us together. It's what about a lot of this work for human rights and social justice is about networking, and it's important to build those networks and friendships. So special thanks to him, and I'm glad you can join us here today. Well, Jack Healy, you've worked with everybody from Dick Gregory to Sting. I mean, just tell people, and you've worked on so many very important campaigns with Joe Strummer, the Aung San Suu Kyi campaign, and you, of course, are very active in the campaign to free Leonard Peltier. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about your background, your history, and then, of course, I know you want to talk about a little more specifically what's going on with Leonard Peltier.
Sure. I come from Irish coal miners in eastern Pennsylvania. Both all my grandparents and uncles and so on were all miners, and we had to fight for our rights. And that tradition was transported to me by my mother, who came from Scranton, Pennsylvania. And I got that sense of justice before peace from her. And she always said to me, the death penalty is just a weapon by the rich against the poor. It's always been that way. It'll always be that way. And I had this sense of justice that was reinforced by my Franciscan training and as a priest. And then I went, luckily, I got out of the seminary. I went to the March on Washington. I heard the great Dr. King give his, you know, the greatest speech of that century. I heard that. That inspired me. When I left the priesthood, I wanted to do something about human rights, rights around the world. So we taught kids, young people, basically, into walking long distances and raising money for world hunger. And we raised about $12-15 million doing that in the Nixon period. So it was a challenging time like we're going into now as well.
Well, it's certainly good to, you know, we were just in our previous segment talking to Laura Wells, who's still with us, the gubernatorial Green Party candidate at one point in California. We were joined by a professor and also a couple students in studio, and we were talking about the millennial generation and about so much legitimate and actual hope going on, not just, you know, a surface kind of thing, but also a lot of the social justice work on the ground is being done by millennials. So it's a really necessary and important thing to see this crossing of generations with people like you, Jack Healey, and also continuing to work with the millennial generation and young folks, very, very important. And your website, humanrightsactioncenter.com, has a lot of your work there, and your book, Create Your Future. You want to talk to the listeners a little bit about the Human Rights Action Center and maybe about your book, and the subtitle, of course, Create Your Future, is How to Make Your Voice Heard from Civil Rights to Human Rights, from Anti-Apartheid to Anti-War. Can you talk a little bit about that, Jack Healey?
I sure can. Thanks. And you know, it was accidental, but I spoke to Leonard Peltier this morning. We spent a good time on the phone speaking. And one of the things that happened down there with Leonard, just to make this real, is Archbishop Wenske of Miami was going to visit him in prison. And at the last minute, that visit was turned down by the warden. So it sort of, you know, he was telling me about that and his right to pray, and it was turned down. So there's a certain effort being made, I think, to thwart, I hope it wasn't, but it seems like it was, to thwart his right to see people of the cloth. But I think in my Human Rights Action Center, what I try to do is follow standards. I believe in standards. I think if the rich and poor have standards that are equal to both, it could be a fair world. I think when they change the goalposts, the rich and the powerful and the mighty change the goalposts on those without, they become shadows in their own nation. And I don't want that to happen to anybody. I think that's quite often in history, presently around the world, too. They turn their citizens into shadows, and they pretend they're not there, but the poor are there, they're there, and they're talented just as much as the rich and the mighty.
Jack Healey, one of the reviews of the Trump victory was the idea that the Democrat Party had really warped into sort of the Davos class, world agenda, transnational capital, and was embedded in that, and that the BRICS vote in Great Britain and the vote here is a rejection of that, certainly by working people. And adding a human rights element to that seems vitally important. Would you agree?
I totally agree. I think standards are terribly important to maintain. That's why I believe in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It's not that it's a cure-all, but it sets the standards and gets all governments looking in the right direction, which is actually cooperating and protecting people. And so when our president-elect speaks to the issue of using torture and waterboarding and using the death penalty, which we've been winning that case against it for a long time now, I think we have to move our country, not just him, but we have to move our country to an anti-torture position and prosecute the people in the Bush period who actually did torture and who gave the command to torture and allowed our soldiers to return into torturers. It was gigantically unfair, and it's of course to the victims who got hurt so badly. And I think we got to really prosecute anybody who breaks the law like that, especially regarding torture, because it's used all over the world. All the governments practically in the world use it usually on a daily basis. And so the more we can fight that and make it clear that we Americans are against torture, we got to do that. We have to do that.
Well, we're speaking with Jack Healy, longtime social justice and human rights activist, certainly working across different platforms, including the arts, head of the Human Rights Action Center. I just wanted to point out briefly that let's remember that 46%+ of the electorate did not vote in the United States, as if a none of the above statement, perhaps, that Hillary Clinton did win the popular vote, right? And we're left with this antiquated electoral college. So we do want to remember these things, that Donald Trump in no way has any type of a mandate to go and continue both the Bush and Obama legacy, with which, frankly, Hillary Clinton was also poised to continue. Wanton slaughter, bombing, abuse of civil rights at home, and human rights abroad. So I think those are important things to remember. And I'd like to remind listeners that you can go to UN.org, the United Nations website, to read the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And you can go to Jack Healy's page, HumanRightsActionCenter.com. And Jack has done some work on that. He's actually got some great interviews there and some synopses of some things happening that are so important with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I'd like to remind listeners that you are listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacific Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. I want to bring back into the conversation Laura Wells. She is still in studio with us and was one-time gubernatorial candidate for the Green Party. And Laura Wells, you've been sitting here and certainly been nodding your head and taking notes, and I know you want to have a few things to add to the conversation. Laura Wells?
One of the things that that dividing line, again, thinking about Standing Rock, where there are those images of people and the earth on one side and the destructive forces on the other side, that there's a lot of that happening right now. You know, the day, Wednesday morning after the election, I wrote a blog called Looking for Courage to Continue. And so I looked at a couple of the things in election results that were hopeful, and they and found a couple. And what it, how it sort of boils down is our human rights on one side, real people on one side, and machinery and war and destruction on the other side. And some of the things that happened, for example, Richmond Progressive Alliance, that wonderful group of
in Richmond, California.
In Richmond, California, where they go up against Chevron. Chevron has refineries there, and they go up against Chevron money, and they take the candidates, the RPA candidates, take no corporate money, no developer money. They beat Chevron. They now have a majority, which they've never had before, but they have a majority now. And even when they didn't have a majority, they were able to go up against Chevron. People went up against the machinery in a couple of other ways too. Voted to the Citizens United. California rejected the Citizens United. California passed legalization of marijuana. Now we need to make sure that it doesn't get corporatized and GMO-ified. And there were other, Jesse Aragon beat the machine in as mayor of Berkeley, and he's the first Latino mayor of Berkeley, and very progressive. Big Soda filled my mailboxes, filled, you know, the airwaves of it fighting against the what they called the grocery tax. It was actually the soda tax. 70 something, like, lost by 20 points. And huge money.
Yes, and Prop 64 marijuana. So, I mean, there certainly are things taking place in California and other places around the country that are not in the same vein as what many progressives view as so-called Trump's America. And these are really important things to remember, Laura Wells. So that's thank you for bringing
it's
those
the
up.
The human side.
That's right. Well, I'd like to remind you again, this is the Project Censored Show on Pacific Radio. We're going to take one more very quick musical break, and we're going to be back and talk some more with Jack Healy. Stay with us. Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with
Peter Phillips. Just before the break, you were listening to California former Green Party gubernatorial candidate Laura Wells, a longtime social justice activist herself. We're also joined by Jack Healy, who is of the Human Rights Action Center. Jack Healy was the executive director of Amnesty International USA for 12 years. And, you know, throughout Jack's, you know, many years of working as a human rights activist, he's been very active in music and arts and the humanities. And Jack Healy, there's two things we want to cover here with you before we have to wrap up the show today. And the first is I'd like you to address is the importance of creativity and the arts in human rights and social justice, you know, movement work. And you, I believe, are among the most qualified people to talk about those intersections. Jack Healy.
Well, I just use the experience of Bruce Springsteen, Sting, Peter Gabriel, Yusuf Ndour, and Tracy Chapman going around the world. We played in 16 countries around the world. We were welcomed everywhere we went. The people of the world are waiting. There's a river of consciousness waiting for the international standards to be set by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And I think in some ways we have to remember that the Leonard Peltier case is an injustice in the sense of the case that Amnesty International declared immediately at the case back in 76 that it was unfair. He served now 41 years, and you can go to I Will Leonard Peltier and see our videos. We have 11 of them up there. And on Human Rights Day, Leonard is asking all the tribes of the American nation to drum in support of him. And we're asking all Americans, as John Lennon did, is to write on their hand, just with their pen, free Leonard Peltier during Human Rights Week, which is December 6th to the 10th. And we want to show the president, so he gets clemency, so that Leonard gets clemency, we want to show the president the massive support behind Leonard and the unfairness he suffered all these years.
Jack, hi, this is Peter Phillips. I am pleased to tell you that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is incorporated in every course I teach, has been for years. And, that's standard. It's a perfectly, you know, moral, ethical standard for people not only to recognize and accept personally, but to encourage government and their organizations to be involved with it as well. Tell us a little bit about the history of how that was developed.
It was developed by Eleanor Roosevelt. Interesting enough, both candidates were from New York, never mentioned it. But the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was passed by the United Nations almost unanimously, a few abstentions, in Paris in 48. And to a great extent, the governments have neglected it ever since its passage. And really, probably less than 5% of the world even know about it or have read it. And so my effort is to get that out. And one of the things I want to do, getting older, what I want to do before, is I want to see the Universal Declaration of Human Rights printed in all the passports of all governments. So we all know the standards. We all know how we're supposed to act. We know what the standards for government. And, you know, poor people can go and use that. Much like Dr. King used the Constitution and the Bill of Rights to point to something bigger than himself, poor people around the world need the Universal Declaration of Human Rights to point to make it bigger than themselves and do the nonviolent fight and take their rights and demand their rights and get their rights and live well.
So, Jack Healy, you're mentioning this upcoming week of action in December on behalf of Leonard Peltier. And can you tell us any more about – can you repeat that one website and then anything else that you might be planning or working towards that you think other people should be knowing about so we can continue to build these networks?
Well, we want to show the nations of the Indian nations across the country will show support for Leonard, and that'll be amazing. It's never been done before, I don't think, in one cause. I think the signing on your hand, Free Leonard, could just spread across the country and show the president that the American people are behind this clemency. He's been in there 41 years. If you add his good behavior in there, he's really been served 46 years, and it's just time to let him go. The case, we could re-argue that because we believe he was innocent. Some say he wasn't. We don't know. But in the clemency, we feel deeply that it was a flawed trial, and Leonard has served illegitimately for 41 years, so we'd like to see him just allow him to go home and live and die among his people, and that's all we want. And I think it would be a message by the President of the United States. It would send a signal, not only to the American Indians, but all the Indians up and down the Americas, I think it would be a signal from our president that he's in touch with our people who have suffered so much in our country. And this would be a great signal for him to leave the office on, alerting them that he deeply cared about them and Leonard's case.
Thank you for joining us today on the Project Censored Show. Jack Healy, author of Create Your Future. You can learn more at humanrightsactioncenter.com. Thanks, Jack Healy.
Thank you, Mickey.
Also like to thank our guests Laura Wells, Anna Rivera, Caitlin McCoy, and Susan Rahman. I have one brief announcement to make. Project Censored's annual book release party and fundraiser will be at Lagunitas Beer Sanctuary. That's in Petaluma, California, 1280 North McDowell Boulevard. You can learn more on our website, projectcensored.org. That's this Monday, November 14th. Monday, November 14th, 5:30 to 8:30. Come here, Bobby Ramirez. Come here, the No Buenos Music. And Davey D from Hard Knock Radio will be there. So please come out and support Project Censored. Go to projectcensored.org. I'm Mickey Huff for Peter Phillips. Thanks to Anthony Fest and everyone for helping us out today. We'll see you next time.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians. Cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaigns. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain. But my people can't.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, An Indigenous People's History of the United States. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz grew up in rural Oklahoma, the daughter of a tenant farmer and part Indian mother. She holds a PhD in history and is an activist in the international indigenous movement for more than four decades. Her 1977 book, The Great Sioux Nation, was the fundamental document at the first international conference on indigenous peoples of the Americas. That conference was held at the United Nations headquarters in Geneva. The late, great Howard Zinn, author of the now world-famous book, A People's History of the United States, was her friend, and he played a role in convincing Beacon Press to commission and publish An Indigenous People's History of the United States. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz had an ongoing friendly controversy with Howard Zinn over an event that is often described as the final victory by the U.S. Army over the last armed Indian resistance, the massacre at Wounded Knee in 1890. Here's Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz.
He was a friend of mine, and all these years I criticized him for terminating the indigenous narrative, the Native American narrative, at the end of the frontier, so-called, basically 1890, with a massacre at Wounded Knee and the end of armed resistance by Native nations. And then suddenly, Native Americans appear again in 1969 with the seizure of Alcatraz. I would tease Howard and say, what happened? Were they hibernating all those years? You know, 70, 80 years. And he said, well, you need to write that book. Yeah. So before he passed away, he suggested to Beacon Press that they do different versions of people's histories that his book couldn't cover, to go in more depth, like African American or Black people's history of the United States, women's history of the United States. And he said, but especially in indigenous people's history of the United States, and you should ask Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz to do it. I now think this was a curse. because of my criticisms. Not really, but it was a very hard book to write because it was to be a concise book, a very readable for the general educated reader, not an academic book, but a book that could be used in university courses or high school courses, sort of like Howard's book. So I'm very proud that this book is a part of Beacon's Revisioning American History series. So I thought I would read from one of the chapters. In the first chapter, I write about the 100,000 years before the Europeans came to the Western Hemisphere and what was going on here and what was going on in Europe that led to the invasion of the Americas by Spain, Portugal, and the Dutch, and the French, and the British, and colonization of the whole Western Hemisphere in Africa. That's called the culture of conquest. So this third chapter I'm going to read to think about the initial colonies. I call this chapter The Cult of the Covenant. So with the onset of colonialism in North America, control of the land was wrenched away from the indigenous peoples, and the forests grew dense so that later European settlers were unaware of the former cultivation and sculpting and manicuring of the landscape. Abandoned fields of corn turned to weeds and bushes. Settlers chopped down trees in New England until the landscape was nearly bare. One geographer notes, paradoxical as it may seem, there was undoubtedly much more forest primeval in 1850 than in 1650. Anglo-Americans who did observe native habitat management in action misunderstood what they saw. Captain John Palliser, traveling through the prairies in the 1850s, complained about the Indians' quote, disastrous habit of setting the prairie on fire for the most trivial and worse than useless reasons, unquote. In the founding myth of the United States, the colonists acquired a vast expanse of land from a scattering of benighted peoples who were hardly using it, an unforgivable offense to the Puritan work ethic. The historical record is clear, however, that European colonists shoved aside a large network of small and large nations whose governments, commerce, arts and sciences, agriculture, technologies, theologies, philosophies and institutions were intricately developed. Nations that maintained sophisticated relations with one another and with the environments that supported them. By the early 17th century, when British colonists from Europe began to settle in North America, a large indigenous population had long before created, quote, a humanized landscape almost everywhere, as William Denevan puts it. Native peoples had created town sites, farms, monumental earthworks, and networks of roads, and they had devised a wide variety of governments, some as complex as any in the world. They had developed sophisticated philosophies of government, traditions of diplomacy, and policies of international relations. They conducted trade along roads that crisscrossed the land masses and waterways of the American continents. Before the arrival of Europeans, North America was indeed a continent of villages, but also a continent of nations and federations of nations. Many have noted that had North America been a wilderness, undeveloped, without roads, and uncultivated, it might still be so, for the European colonists could not have survived. They appropriated what had already been created by indigenous civilizations. They stole already cultivated farmland and the corn, vegetables, tobacco, and other crops domesticated over centuries, took control of the deer parks that had been cleared and maintained by indigenous communities, used existing roads and water routes in order to move armies to conquer, and relied on captured indigenous people to identify the locations of water, oyster beds, and medicinal herbs. Well, all modern nation states claim a kind of rationalized origin story upon which they fashion patriotism or loyalty to the state. When citizens of modern states and their anthropologists and historians look at what they consider, quote, primitive societies, they identify their origin myths, quaint and endearing stories, but fantastic ones not grounded in reality. Yet many U.S. scholars seem unable or unwilling to subject their own nation-state's founding story to the same objective examination. The United States is not unique among nations in forging an origin myth, but most of its citizens believe it to be exceptional among nation-states. And this exceptionalist ideology has been used to justify appropriation of the continent and then domination of the rest of the world. Is one of the few states founded on the covenant of the Hebrew Torah or the Christian borrowing of it in the Old Testament of the Bible. Other covenant states are Israel and the now defunct apartheid state of South Africa, both of which were founded in 1948. Although the origin stories of these three covenant states were based on Judeo-Christian scripture, they were not founded as theocracies. According to the myths, the faithful citizens come together of their own free will and pledge to each other and to their God to form and support a godly society, and their God in turn vouchsafes them prosperity in a promised land, or manifest destiny. The influence of the scriptures was pervasive among many of the Western social and political thinkers whose ideas the founders of the first British colonies in North America drew upon. Historian Donald Harmon Akinson points to the way that certain societies in certain eras of their development have looked to the scriptures for guidance and likens it to the way the human genetic code operates physiologically. That is, this great code has, in some degree, directly determined what people would believe and what they would do. Dan Jacobson, a citizen of Boer-ruled South Africa whose parents were immigrants, observes that, like the Israelites and their fellow Calvinists in New England, the Boers believed that they had been called by their God to wander through the wilderness, to meet and defeat the heathen, and to occupy a promised land on his behalf. A sense of their having been summoned by divine degree to perform an ineluctable historical duty, and this never has left the Boers and has contributed to both their strength and their weakness. Founders of the first North American colonies and later of the United States had a similar sense of providential opportunity to make history. Indeed, as Akinson reminds us, it is from the scriptures that Western society learned how to think historically. The key moment in history, according to covenant ideology, involves the winning of the land from alien and indeed evil forces. U.S. citizens did not inherit their cult-like adherence to their Constitution from the English. From the Pilgrims to the founders of the United States and continuing to the present, the cultural persistence of the covenant idea and thus the bedrock of U.S. patriotism represents a deviation from the main course in the development of national identities. Arguably, both the 1948 birth of the State of Israel and advent of the Nationalist Party rule of South Africa in 1948 were emulations of the U.S. founding. Certainly many U.S. Americans closely identify with the State of Israel as they did with Afrikaner-ruled South Africa. Patriotic U.S. politicians and citizens take pride in exceptionalism. Historians and legal theorists characterize U.S. statecraft and empire as those of a nation of laws, rather than one dominated by a particular class or group of interests, suggesting a kind of holiness. Parallel to the idea of the U.S. Constitution as covenant, politicians, journalists, teachers, and even professional historians chant like a mantra that the United States is a nation of immigrants. These were the settlers who fought their way over the Appalachians into the fertile Ohio Valley region, and it is they who claim blood sacrifice for their country. Immigrants, to be accepted, must prove their fidelity to the covenant and what it stands for. These, then, were the settlers upon which the national myths are based, the ultimately dispensable cannon fodder for the taking of the land and the continent, the foot soldiers of empire, the yeoman farmers romanticized by Thomas Jefferson. The next chapter is called Bloody Footprints, and it's about basically how the U.S. Army was formed in the wars against the native people east of the Mississippi. This is a quote from a military historian, John Grenier, in a book called The First Way of War. For the first 200 years of our military heritage, then, Americans depended on arts of war that contemporary professional soldiers supposedly abhorred, raising and destroying enemy villages and fields, killing enemy women and children, raiding settlements for captives, intimidating and brutalizing enemy noncombatants, and assassinating enemy leaders. In the frontier wars between 1607 and 1814, Americans forged two elements, unlimited war and irregular war, into their first way of war, which is still their way of war. So I make, throughout the book, connections between the U.S. military today and its foundation in these unrelenting wars that actually went up through 1890 and then moved overseas to the Philippines and the Caribbean with the same generals in the Philippines who had been fighting the Sioux and the Cheyenne in the northern plains. And interestingly enough, also, who were called in, one division of them, to fight striking workers in Chicago. So I think there's very interesting interconnections with the use of the military in the United States that we don't always put together. You know, the Second Amendment and the irregular warfare, these were mostly settler militias who could organize themselves. Andrew Jackson started that way as the head of the Tennessee militia. His militia's war against the Muscogee Creeks, driving them out of Georgia, he was made a major general in the U.S. Army. So it was a career builder as well to start a militia. But these were also used, especially after U.S. independence, as slave patrols, these militias, self-appointed militias. These militias would form to police free. You know, they weren't paid to do it. And we still see the ghosts of this performing, actually, today.
You're listening to Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, author of the 2014 Beacon Press book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States. I recorded her at Green Apple, one of the last used bookstores in San Francisco. Howard Zinn convinced Beacon Press to publish a series of forgotten and suppressed histories under the title Revisioning American History. Two issues have already been covered, disability and the queer history of the U.S. He requested that Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz be asked to write the Indigenous Peoples edition. In the Q&A session, she was asked to speak about the origin of AIM, the American Indian Movement.
The American Indian Movement, which started in 1968 and still exists, not as powerfully as it once did, it was a pan-Indian movement. People who started it were Anishinaabe and Lakota, and very strongly identified with their heritage, their languages, and so forth. But they reached out to everyone. They saw as their model Tecumseh, right after the independence, to 1808. they fought to keep people out of the Ohio Valley. And they famously, he and his brother, who was a medicine man, traveled all over and brought people together, different peoples from very different backgrounds, including organizing down in the South so that after he was killed, after they were killed, the brothers, the Seminole Wars took over. And the Seminoles were, of course, mixed African, escaped Africans and Muscogee Creeks. Their language was Creek, was Muscogee. And that was Jackson then trying to force them to give up the Africans among them, and with a promise they could keep this, keep that territory in the Everglades. But they wouldn't. They said, how can we do that? They had intermarried. They had children. We'd be giving you our own flesh. The American Indian movement knew, there were people who knew, who had been in prison. Two of the founders, the Anishinaabe, Clyde Billicourt, and Dennis Banks, were in Stillwater Prison in Minnesota. So they wanted to Indianize everyone on the continent. This was their goal. And interestingly enough, the same thing was taking place in South America with the South American Indian Council in Bolivia. Their goal was to rescue the Indian in the mestizo. So this was, really a powerful movement in the 1960s of gift giving, of land is sacred, not property, and to recruit people of all kinds. Chicanos were involved from the very beginning. Chicanos were very organized then. They were organized into the Brown Berets, for instance. So there were alliances with the Brown Berets, with the Young Lords, with the Black Panther Party, and these rainbow alliances before Jesse Jackson took that name. They called themselves Rainbow. So there was a lot of interchange. And then right after Wounded Knee, they formed the International Indian Treaty Council, which included also the Pacific, the Maori of New Zealand, the Australian Aborigines, anyone who self-identifies as indigenous. So, yeah, there's a lot of solidarity, and there's a lot of intermarriage, and there's a great desire on the part of almost every Native American I know to learn Spanish, to be able to communicate with some of the people coming in now. I think someone told me when I was in Los Angeles recently that there are probably about 100,000 indigenous Oaxacans in Southern California now. Keeps the right wing awake at night. I just love thinking of Pat Buchanan having nightmares about all these Indians taking over North America. I don't know if you've read Leslie Silko's Almanac of the Dead. You know, Leslie Marmon Silko, she's a poet and a writer. And Almanac of the Dead, she published it in 1992, the quincentenary year. And she laid out a scenario in Chiapas that literally came true 2 years later. It is really remarkable to read that. And then the day I heard about the Zapatistas rising up, the Tetzal Mayans in Chiapas, New Year's Day, 1994, I thought, my God, this sounds like Leslie's story, that she was telling. So it's pretty interesting. But she lives in Tucson, out in the country. She has a ranch with horses and stuff. There's a freight train that goes by coming up from Mexico. And, of course, the top is just filled with people. And she wrote an essay, well, this was like 20 years ago, in The Nation magazine, saying this is what keeps her alive every day, is looking and seeing it, all those young Indians up on that freight train coming in to replenish the law population in North America.
That was a quote from an essay by Leslie Marmon Silko, Laguna Pueblo author, in the Native American Renaissance. Among her novels are Ceremony and Gardens in the Dunes. The last question came from me. Did you write about the gold rush in California?
I'll read you a passage to get a sense of it. This is the chapter called Sea to Shining Sea, United States taking half of Mexico and then getting to California. They hadn't yet conquered the interior, but they got sea to shining sea. Under the protection of the U.S. Army, beginning in 1848, gold seekers from all over the world brought death, torture, rape, starvation, and disease to the indigenous peoples whose ancestral territories included the sought-after gold fields north and east of San Francisco, peoples who had never been colonized by the Spanish. As Alejandro Murguia, our poet laureate of San Francisco, by the way, describes it, in a wonderful book called Medicine of Memory. Unlike the native peoples for whom gold was irrelevant, the 49ers hungered for gold with a sickness. So I'll read you a passage from his book. They would do anything for it. They left families, homes, everything behind. They sailed for 8 months aboard leaky, smelly ships to reach California. Others, captains and sailors, jumped ship at San Francisco, leaving a fleet of abandoned brigs, barks, and schooners to rot by the piers. They slaughtered all the game they could find and so muddied the rivers and creeks with silt that the once plentiful salmon couldn't survive. The herds of elk and deer, the food source for Native Americans, were practically wiped out in one summer. The miners cheated and killed each other in the gold fields. So in a true reign of terror, the U.S. occupation and settlement exterminated more than 100,000 California Native people in 25 years, reducing the population to 30,000 by 1870, quite possibly the most extreme demographic disaster of all time. Here, too, against impossible odds, the indigenous peoples resisted and survived to tell the story. Had they not done so, there would be no indigenous peoples remaining in Northern California, because the objective was to eradicate them. From the onset of the California gold rush, crazed gold bugs invaded indigenous territories, terrorizing and brutally killing those who were in their path. These settlers seemed to require no military assistance in running roughshod over unarmed indigenous residents. The role left for the U.S. Army was to round up the starving indigenous refugees to transport them to established reservations in Oregon and Oklahoma. Yeah, some of them were actually sent to Oklahoma. So thanks for that question. Yes, you live up in the...
That was the first part of a one-hour program with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, author, activist, and historian. Her most recent book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, was published by Beacon Press in the fall of 2014. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz grew up in rural Oklahoma, the daughter of a part Indian mother and a tenant farmer. After receiving her Ph.D. in history at the University of California at Los Angeles, she taught in the newly established Native American Studies program at Cal State Hayward, and she helped found the Departments of Ethnic and Women's Studies there. Dunbar-Ortiz is the author or editor of seven other books, including Roots of Resistance, A History of Land Tenure in New Mexico, The Great Sioux Nation, Red Dirt, Growing Up Okie, and Blood on the Border, Memoir of the Contra War. She lives in San Francisco. Come back for more Q&A, including a discussion about the Great Sioux Nation. when TUC Radio returns. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. If you're unable to download online, you can get an audio CD at cost on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Listen to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Why is British Columbia being made a sacrifice zone for Alberta? And in the United States, why are Washington and Oregon being made a sacrifice zone for North Dakota? This is actually the most hopeful thing to me in the environmental movement, that we're pairing environmental issues with economic issues.
That's the voice of singer-songwriter Dana Lyons. On this week's show, Sylvia interviews Dana on his latest album, The Great Sailor She. So stay tuned.
Swim 1,000 miles to reach the shores of Emerald Isles, with salmon spawning by the million, herring spawning by the billion. Gather with our pods again, the summer food, the summer friends, to raise our babies safe and free. We gather in the Salish Sea. Oh, hush, hear the swish of the boats on the water, the hollowed out cedars, the sons and the daughters, the rhythm of paddles caressing the water, the rhythm of paddles to come greet the orca. Remember the legend, the myth and the story, a long time ago when we witnessed the glory, with thousands and thousands of whales swimming free. The orcas come home to the great Salish Sea. Song from many miles, your distant thoughts, your distant smiles. Today we fish in different bays, tonight we meet again to play. Oh, hush, hear the swish of the boats on the water, the great sailing ships with sons and the daughters. waters, the wind and the wood as it cuts through the water, the wind and the wood sailing out to the orca. Remember the legend, the myth and the story, a long time ago when we witnessed the glory of thousands and thousands of whales swimming free. The orcas come home to the great sailor sea. Oh, 100 times around the sun, I saw the slaughter, smelled the blood, the water turned. Song today, the salmon gone, the herring late, and more the ships do come. Will anybody hear my song, or hush hear the scream of the ships on the water, the great super tankers, the coal ports, the freighters, the deafening noise overtaking the water, the deafening noise overcoming the orca. Remember the legend, the myth and the story, a long time ago.
I'm very privileged to be joined this evening by Dana Lyons. The song you are listening is the beautiful Salish Sea. Very privileged to have you on our program, Dana. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Sylvia. Hello.
Hello, Dana. You know, when I think about the idea of a Salish Sea, the idea that we live in this beautiful, beautiful ecosystem, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how that song came about, how what inspired that beautiful song? I love listening to it because it just makes me feel so connected, so in tune with the place that I live in.
Yes, the Salish Sea is written from the point of view of the 103-year-old matriarch of the resident J-pod orcas that live here in the beautiful Salish Sea. And her name is Granny, and she's still with us. And I wrote it from her point of view, kind of thinking about the changing sound of boats over the last century, going from the Native American canoes to the great sailing ships to the, you know, giant freighters and oil and coal ships of today. And I learned about the effect of big ship noise on the orcas when I was on the Great Coal Train Tour. I traveled, I did 75 shows following the route of the proposed coal export train going from Montana back through Idaho, Washington, Oregon, and up to Bellingham. At the first show, there was an orca scientist there who spoke about the effect of these giant ships, the noise from these giant ships on the orcas. When there are no giant ships going, and the water is quiet, the orcas can talk to each other 5-7 kilometers or more away. So literally, you know, the mom can be in one bay, the child can be in the next bay, and they could be chatting while they're fishing. When the big ships are going by, instead of being able to hear each other 7 kilometers, they can maybe hear each other 100 meters. So it's really drastic, and you can imagine what it does to their ears, what it does to their bodies, and their ability to communicate. It's really a safety thing. So that's where the song came from, and I'm touring with that song and that album now, just, you know, raising awareness about you know, the plight of the orcas, the effect of the proposed coal and oil export out of both the U.S. and Canada, and that's what it's about.
You know, when I was thinking about the way that you not only are attuned to the needs of the whales, you know, how does a whale hear? How do they communicate? And what impact does our footprint, you know, our actions have in their lives? I'm so moved by that story, but I'm also aware that, you know, we live in a point in society where we're told that civilization looks like this, you know, the destruction is inevitable. And I'm really inspired by the Coltrane tour, because I think it not only raises awareness about what it is we are creating, but also about the alternatives, about the ways that we can coexist in a way that, you know, acknowledges all beings, all living things, that we are all part of one ecosystem. There's another song that I really love in your CD, and that is The Salmon Come Home. And I was wondering if you could just maybe introduce the song, and then I'd like to play the song for our audience.
Yes, I'd be happy to. For years, my friends up in Alaska who were working to, you know, stop a giant coal mine on a river in Alaskan territory, in Athabascan territory, they've been wanting me to write a song about it. And basically, it's a little village of an Athabascan village of Tyonik, which is 60 miles west across the Cook Inlet from Anchorage. They're proposing to dig up a river 13 miles of the Salmon River, dig 300 feet down, remove all the rock. It will completely destroy the river. It will completely destroy the salmon, all to dig up coal. Needless to say, this is very serious for the river. It's also where the village that has been there, you know, time immemorial, gets their food. It will destroy their food. So the native peoples there are fighting it fiercely, as are the environmentalists and many Alaskans. But I went there. They flew me in. Actually, my friend hired me to do to be a camp counselor there for a week. And he's like, yeah, you can see the place, meet the kids, talk to the elders, get the story. And I did that. And I was privileged to spend 3 hours with an elder who told me a lot about their history and told me a lot about the mine. And in the song, I incorporate a lot of the specific history of the people of Tyonik and the Athabascan people of that region. And it's, you know, talks about, you know, all the different things they've overcome throughout history. But now, when your food is taken from you, that's the end of the story. That could force them to leave that place forever. And so it's that struggle. And I'm happy to say that, you know, so far the mine has not been built. Your listeners may have heard of the Pebble Mine. It's a more famous mine proposal out in Bristol Bay, Alaska. But both the Chewitna Mine and the Pebble Mine are precedent-setting mines. The mining industry in Alaska wants to set the precedent for mining entire rivers. You know, it's insane. It's absolutely insane. But that's what we're fighting in Alaska, and hopefully with diligence we'll be able to hold them off.
This is Salmon Come Home by Dana Lyons.
Salmon come home again and again since the beginning of time, the beginning of when we've been living here. We've been living here forever. The salmon come home again and again since the beginning of time, the beginning of when we've been living here. We've been living on this land forever. Then the Russians came for the fur and ground. They built log forts and we burned them down. Then the great flu came, taking old and young. We gathered who was left and we begin again. The salmon come home again and again since the beginning of time, the beginning of when we've been living here. We've been living here forever. Salmon come home again and again since the beginning of time, the beginning of when we've been living here. We've been living on this land forever. Then the oil rigs came, promising us jobs, leaving oil sheens as we carry on. Then the loggers came, taking the great trees, leaving mountains bare, leaving muddy streets. The salmon come home again and again since the beginning of time, the beginning of
this land forever. Now they come for the coal underneath our river to destroy our home, take our children's future. We are one small town. We are one proud people. We are one with salmon. We are one with eagle. We are one small town. We are one proud people. We are still surviving. We are still surviving. I do not believe Creator wants this to happen. I do not believe Creator wants this to happen. I do not believe Creator wants this to happen. I do not believe Creator wants this to happen. The salmon come home again and again since the beginning of time, the beginning of when we've been living here. We've been living here forever. The salmon come home again and again since the beginning of time, the beginning of when we've been living here. We've been living on this land forever. We've been living here. We've been living on this land forever. The salmon come home again and 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 again.
That was a beautiful song. You know, I was thinking about how water is such a unifying theme for all of us. We all need the water. We all need to have access, you know, to our food supplies. And so it's always a question. People always say, you know, well, how, if everybody's against it, why is it happening in that area? And I always wonder, you know, well, maybe we're not being asked. Maybe, you know, a lot of this decisions are being taken in our names, but without us there. And I was speaking with a Hopi woman, and she said to me, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. And so
that's a great line.
And, you know, but this is how it feels, right? It's how it feels. You know, we are not being consulted. We're obviously not willing to give up our identity. You know, if you live in the ocean, if you live near the ocean becomes part of who you are. It forms and informs the way you see the world, the way you interact with the world. And so what happens when the salmon are gone, when they've been such a part of your life, of your history, of who you are, of how you understand the world, you know? I was reading a story about how the salmon go, you know, from their spawning grounds, which are usually freshwater rivers, into the ocean, you know, miles and miles. And it's like, to me, that's like the classic hero story. You know, you go and venture and then you return home. You know, you return home to spawn and create life and be a be part of that continuum of life. I'm very moved by all your work, and I'm really moved by this particular song. But there's another song in your CD that I'm really excited about, and it's a matter of asking. And I wonder if you could tell us the story of how you know, what inspired the song? What's behind that song?
Sure. I was on tour in Hawaii, and I was on the island of Molokai, which is relatively close to Maui, and Molokai is probably the poorest of all the Hawaiian islands, and it's also the has the highest percentage of native Hawaiians. When I was there, I was staying with a family who were fighting small cruise ships from coming to the island. And I asked, well, what's wrong with these little cruise ships coming here? Doesn't it bring jobs and stuff? And what she said is, well, one, you know, they want to dump their garbage here because we're the poorest place, so they can get cheap garbage things. And I'm like, okay, that's reasonable to be against, but, you know, are there other reasons? And she said, well, we might be open to the cruise ships coming here, but it's a matter of asking us. And I think it was in 1996 or 98, the U.S. President Clinton issued an official apology because the United States government, they took over Hawaii. They stole Hawaii, and it's, you know, of questionable legality that the United States owns that now. And he issued an apology, and as part of the discussion that was going on then, they had the idea, well, we're going to try to give, you know, even though it still would be part of the United States, we're going to give the Native Hawaiians more say over certain issues. In other words, we will ask their permission for some things. Well, the island of Molokai has implemented that. They've created councils and councils of elders and said to outsiders coming in, outside companies and governments, you have to ask us first. So really it was a matter of asking, and that's the title of the song. And I thought that was fascinating because it's really the essence of democracy. You know, someone from the outside or anyone, even someone from the local, wants to do something. Do you ask the people? Do you ask the elders? You'll ask the elected officials, or do you just run right over them and do it anyway? And it raises that whole question.
That's beautiful. We are listening to Dana Lyons, and this next song is It's a Matter of Asking.
It's a matter of asking. It's a matter of listening to us. It's a matter of honoring the elders, the council, the will of the people. Your people came here so long ago, took the land, destroyed our culture. Now you say you want to make it right, create a country within a country. It's a matter of asking. It's a matter of listening to us. It's a matter of honoring the elders, the council, the will of the people. You call a homestead native land, and then Monsanto farms it with poison. You wanna bring in your cruise ships and dump your garbage because we are poor here. It's a matter of asking. It's a matter of listening to us. It's a matter of honoring the elders, the council, the will of the people. On an island of waterfalls, when the great monsoon rains cry. On an island of memories, we survive. Of waterfalls, when the great monsoon rains cry. On an island of memories, we survive. It's easy talking about justice, a little harder when you're sharing the power, asking the will of the people. The people say yes, sometimes they say no. It's a matter of asking. It's a matter of listening to us. It's a matter of honoring the elders, the council, the will of the people. It's a matter of asking. It's a matter of talking with us. It's a matter of honoring. It's a matter of asking.
Beautiful song, Dana. perhaps you could talk a little bit about our last song, which we're going to be playing. It's called Sometimes, and also tell our audience how they can access your music.
Sure. You can get autographed CDs at my website, which is cowswithguns.com, and you can also hear, you know, just listen to my songs for free at cowswithguns.com. Also, you can get downloads at iTunes and other places like that. The Sometimes song, that song I wrote about the efforts in Washington and Oregon to stop the coal export train. Our region, Washington, Oregon, and British Columbia, we are under threat. The Salish Sea is under threat from, you know, the tar sands, the proposed tar sands pipelines in British Columbia, the coal and oil trains coming into Washington, Oregon, and British Columbia. And I know that you in British Columbia are putting up a great fight against those pipelines. I know that's still in the air. I know that will affect the next election for you. In Washington, Oregon, we've been doing extremely well on the coal trains. 3 years ago, there were 6 proposed new coal ports in Washington and Oregon. Today, there are 2. We've beaten 4 of them, and we plan on beating the other 2 also. And the way we're doing that is basically that people are speaking out extremely loudly against it. We have a very unique and powerful coalition fighting against those. Both Democrats and Republicans are against them. Business people are against them. The Native peoples are against them. The environmentalists are against them. I would estimate that 70% to 80% of the people are against the coal trains. And we are giving the coal industry and the U.S. federal government a run for their money. And I think in the end we will beat all 6, and we're gearing up to fight these exploding oil trains. And it's a very unique time for the Salish Sea region, because basically what's interesting is if we lose the fight in Washington or Oregon, you all can get an oil spill up in British Columbia and vice versa if you lose up there. So we really, as a region, we are standing up against the forces of big oil and big coal, and both our federal governments are trying to ram this through. And the reason why I think we can win is because it's not just an environmental issue. It's not just a land rights issue. It's an economic issue. What happens to Vancouver's economy if there's an oil spill? What happens to all the Gulf Islands? What happens to Seattle's economy if there's an oil spill, if a pipeline bursts in a river, if it bursts going across the Fraser? What happens if the oil train derails in the Columbia? And I raise the question, why is Alberta's economy more important than British Columbia's? Why is British Columbia being made a sacrifice zone for Alberta? And in the United States, why are Washington and Oregon being made a sacrifice zone for North Dakota? And that this is actually the most hopeful thing to me in the environmental movement, that we're pairing environmental issues with economic issues. And local economy, when local economies are threatened, enough people will gather together that we can fight and we can win. And I'm hoping that we'll all be successful in the Salish Sea.
Thank you again for being with us this evening.
Thanks, Sylvia.
When you hear the great horn sound, the big steel wheels grinding, the 3 lights bearing down, when a sound that once seemed friendly now is tearing at your heart, there's no backing down. Sometimes the people stand up for a reason. When you see the long train coming, and it's coming to your town, and it's carrying the poison in 100,000 cars, and you hear your daughter coughing when it wakes her in the night.
asthma, jumping rope on the playground. When you know we're all against it, and our voices do not count, there's no backing down.
We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.